want to create a world where everybody is happy all the time, doing all of the things that, if you're from a good religious upbringing, is wrong to do. If you're not from a religious upbringing, but you have a good brain and you understand the purpose of morals and ethics, it's still the wrong thing to do. If you're a thinking person. And then the priests had an army. Oh boy, weren't they happy with that? Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated? With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday, the 28th of October, 2022. Well, actually, for me, it's Saturday the 29th, because I'm in New Zealand. Martin, where are you?
In Leinster, in Herefordshire.
But actually, the show really is also live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre, amazingly, in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and at radioqUK.com in Camberley. Sorry, also on the Not the BCFM Politics Show apps, the various of the apps, various versions, Apple, etc., available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner once more, gaslighting us with military-grade Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda and the COVID medical misinformation, where an estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily, according to Dr. Tess Laurie from Bath. Because they didn't get treated with things like chloroquine and ivermectin, deliberately didn't, in fact. So, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And Pfizer pilloried in the European Parliament this week, a pregnant women apparently, to get the boosters, but no one's actually tested the boosters on pregnant women, so one of the MEPs said. And our new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, how slick he's managed to slide in to Downing Street. Isn't that nice? With a great big World Economic Forum sign above the door. Rishi Sunak and his social credit firm. What is China's social credit system? So we look at that, because Sunak is connected with his family. He's connected with an attempt to run social credit in India. Well, no less. What about our Chancellor? Yes, it's him, Jeremy Hunt. What's he been up to? Some interesting stuff in The Guardian this week about him setting up charities and then funneling all the money from donations to the charity, etc., into the pocket of the chief executive of the charity. In part two, we'll be talking about Pakistan, the murder of a journalist who's exiled from Pakistan after death threats there, actually does get a bullet in Kenya. So obviously somebody somewhere doesn't like Imran Khan or anyone on the television in Pakistan saying anything good about Imran Khan, as we were hearing from Farouk Sadiq a few weeks ago, hopefully having him back this week to refresh our memory on what's going on over there. Because obviously this is a big important part of Bristol's community. He's from the Bristol Pakistan Association. And this is one of the things, by the way, I love to do in journalism, is to find people who are locally an expert on, Pakistani community in Bristol, say, whether it is even the Chinese community in Bristol, etc. We can easily, we've got enough expertise and community knowledge in our city to look at anything that's going on around the planet and commentate on it. So that's what we'll be doing tonight. why are journalists who support the elected president, prime minister of a country, being murdered? And hardly a word is said about it. Also, did Ukraine help North Korea to build its nuclear weapons? Scott Ritter talks about this week's nuclear exercise called Steadfast Noon 2022. Is it a good time to be having a nuclear exercise to do with a war with Russia? Is that the sensible thing to be doing this week? It finishes on Sunday. We can all, you know, hold our breath till then. Also, the Communist Party, Chinese Communist Party's Congress has come to a close. And Barry Smith, three evil figures at the end of the world. He's a New Zealand preacher that died, must be probably 15, maybe even 20 years ago now. But anyway, Martin, obviously the main news of the week is Britain has got a new prime minister. What do you make of him?
Well, I mean, he's been around for a while, so he's hardly a completely new figure. I mean, it's been an absolute roller coaster ride for everybody, hasn't it, really? And I think the fact that Johnson didn't stand in the end opened the door for Rishi Sunak to just be shooed in by the Tory MPs. Because, of course, if it had gone to the Tory faithful, it's quite likely Rishi wouldn't have been elected by them.
Don't Tory party rules say that the membership has to play a part in all this?
Not if there is only one candidate. And what the 1922 committee did was they said, in order to expedite this, anybody who's going to be a candidate has to get at least 100 votes. Boris Johnson claimed to have 102 votes, although no, there was only 60 people who put their hands up. And then he decided he wasn't going to run, and therefore nobody else had got 100 votes. Rishi Sunak was the only one. So he then becomes prime minister without going to the Tory membership. If it had gone to the Tory membership, the markets would have panicked, because it would have meant possibly the return of Boris Johnson and, you know, more, you know, really the ship is in heavy seas at the moment, and that you know, the speculators in the currency markets and in the gilt market would have trashed the economy. That still may happen, of course, but Rishi, for the time being, has managed to steady the ship.
Well, this is, I mean, what you've just pointed out there is that the system that we've got at the moment, even though we call it democracy, won't accept ordinary people who've joined the Tory party. Well, not necessarily ordinary, all of them. Some of them rather extraordinary. But the idea is that actually it's no good letting these people choose a leader.
Well, in the Tory party, traditionally, they didn't choose the leader. It was William Hague who brought in the whole idea of Tory party membership having a say. And there's no rule in our unwritten constitution that says that political parties have to be democratic. The Farage party, the Brexit party, was Farage's personal project. He didn't have any democracy.
The Labour Party. Martin, I mean, it's all very well you poking fun at the other parties, but the Labour Party has just been exposed by Al Jazeera, the Labour files, as undermining its own. So, you know, the party itself decided that the leader that the membership had and the unions had elected wasn't the right one, i.e. Jeremy Corbyn, and they decided that they were going to destroy him from within their own party.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Labour Party used to have a constitution whereby the constituency parties had a say and the unions had a say, but it wasn't a one-person, one-vote election. That was brought in by Ed Miliband after the unions put him in power, as opposed to his brother, David Miliband. And then, of course, that opened the door to Corbyn on a one-person, one-vote ticket to get elected. But traditionally, the Labour Party wasn't a one-person, one-vote party. And the Liberal Democrats have been for quite a long time. But of course, back in the past, in the 19th century or whatever, political parties were run by the party in Parliament, and members were simply supporters. They didn't have any power to change what happened in Parliament. And then, in a sense, the Tory party reverted to type, whereby the MPs decide who they want to be prime minister, and that's it.
Anyway, the major thing with I can see with Rishi, which I hadn't seen anything about this previously in the run-up to it, it's pretty, I think, quite devastating, really, is this company Infosys, a multi-billion dollar corporation, heavily in bed with the World Economic Forum, says the article I'm looking at Voice of Wales. And Sunak's father-in-law, Narayana Murthy, is an Indian billionaire businessman, the founder of Infosys, previously the chairman of a company before he retired in 2011. Once retired, he took the title chairman emeritus. So after leaving the company, Murthy's daughter, that is Rishi Sunak's wife, Akshata Murthy, decided to buy shares in the company. In April 2022, total of her shares was valued at about $700 million. One of the projects that Infosys is known for is the development of the Aadhaar card, the largest social credit system currently being operated in India. The Aadhaar card is a 12-digit unique identity for every Indian individual, including children and infants, and enables identification for every resident Indian. So this isn't just an ID card, Martin. This is rather like the Chinese social credit system, which, I mean, I think, to be honest, in many parts of the Western world, these social credit things have been operating behind the scenes anyway, with specific people being, you know, basically targeted, by, you know, profiled, stopped from having a decent career, this sort of thing. But this is being formalized by Rishi's family's company over in India. I mean, right, it does remind me rather of the attempt to turn India cashless, which was such a disaster.
Yeah, well, obviously, he's very well embedded within the global financial elite. And that's his attraction to many of the Tory party's wealthy supporters. They feel he's one of them and that he's competent to manage the country in a way that Liz Truss and Boris Johnson weren't. But of course, he is. He does carry all this baggage.
Well, also Goldman Sachs, of course. I mean, they're right when they say that he's more competent than Liz Truss. But actually, that's not saying a lot, is it?
No. I mean, he's also the choices he's going to make going forward. They could, for example, bring in windfall taxes on the oil companies and on the energy companies and use that to fund their project, you know, the idea of keeping everybody's energy bills down. But again, that's keeping energy bills down for everybody, including the wealthy. And there's lots of economists who think that's a silly idea because it's just a waste of
money. I notice his support for energy companies is going to conk out after one winter. So, I mean, it's almost as if they're setting things up for a disaster to come.
Well, what they're going to do is that the right wing of the Tory party and many people in the City of London, they want a new round of austerity. And I think that's probably what's coming because we can't raise taxes on the wealthy, obviously. We were trying to cut taxes on the wealthy under Liz Truss. We can't raise them and therefore we're going to have to cut public expenditure in order to balance the books, which, of course, we don't necessarily have to do. But in Rishi Sunak's universe, we've got to do it. And that means, of course, that the public sector is going to be devastated, which will, of course, wreck the economy.
Well, I'll put a link up to maybe even a couple of articles about Rishi Sunak's connection to this Aadhaar card, an Infosys, this company, his family links to it, obviously a very wealthy lot. The Aadhaar card in India tracks everything you purchase, your location, what medicines you've taken, and is essentially, though disguised by the mainstream press, a social credit system, just like the one implemented in China. The Aadhaar card uses algorithms, among other pieces of technology, to determine if you're allowed to be in certain areas and whether you're allowed to work, travel, buy food. Oh, we're going to say whether you're allowed to buy food or not. Oh, okay. Or even get medical treatment. This system worked hand in hand with vaccine passports to determine whether you're allowed to travel, buy food, or even go to the hospital. Those who aren't vaccinated or committed a thought crime online would be rendered unable to visit a bar, restaurant, or buy food. Well, this is a system of slavery that's being implemented. The idea of attaching a little toggle to every single individual on the planet, if possible, but obviously in India and China, this sort of thing is now progressing, which says this person, it's almost like, there is something pretty sinister about this, Martin, even though it's going on in China, I think you'd agree. where you say, well, depending on your views and your activity, we're going to flag you up as either kind of red, amber, or green. And if you're red, you basically got to stay at home. You're not allowed to do anything and maybe starve. If you're green, you're a model citizen, and we're going to back and support you, and you can use all the technology, all of the infrastructure that's been set up around our country.
Well, I haven't really researched what Infosys does, but I imagine that it's not, in fact, compulsory, that they want people to sign up to have this card, which will then allow them to do X, Y, and Z. But, you know, you can imagine in some of the slums in India and in the rural areas where they haven't really got electricity, it's not really going to be a runner. And I've got, you know, Bill Gates was pushing this idea of giving people a unique identity which would allow them to do things. But it wasn't compulsory. It's something that people would sign up for in order to get benefits. So it's not quite the same as the social credit system.
Well, in a country which is going into mass poverty or whatever, then actually having some government handouts is going to be essential to live, isn't it? I mean, they've set up a system.
It wouldn't necessarily be government handouts
they've set up a system which could easily turn into literally slave system. But anyway, I mean, you know, I'm sure you know how this stuff works over in China. So, well, I mean, I certainly thought it's worth refreshing looking at all this because of Sunak's involvement. Do you want to just say something about the attempts to turn India cashless, because quite obviously that was a disaster? They did try it, didn't they? Wasn't about 10 years ago or something, Martin? The globalists.
Well, it's not 10 years ago, it's more recently than that.
Was it really? Okay, yeah. It's not going to work, is it? And surely in a country like India, which just doesn't have the electronics infrastructure to allow for a cashless society.
Well, Narendra Modi was under pressure from the USAID, which is the American, basically the CIA, and they wanted to run this out. You know, some countries like Switzerland, you can imagine that having a cashless society probably perfectly feasible because everybody's got bank accounts and mobile phones and all the rest of it. But of course, in India, that's just not the case. And they took in all large denomination notes of cash, and they tried to get rid of, them. But of course, large parts of the Indian economy are based on cash. You know, people selling tea in the street and rickshaw drivers and so on. They don't take cards. So it was, and it caused all sorts of problems for smaller businesses. And eventually they had to back down, partly because the electorally it was starting to affect Modi's BJP party. So, I mean, in a way, it's quite bizarre that a country like India, which has got huge social divisions, should be the country that would try and bring in a cashless setup. It was under US pressure.
This is quite clearly an elite above the Prime Minister, etc., trying something out on India. This is the whole point of having an elite, is that you can get some political party or whatever to run this stuff out on the people. It's not really a democracy. What it is, it's almost like a kind of people farm. Let's try this thing out and see if how the people react, even though they've not consented to it. So a bit like, I suppose it's a bit like foisting a whole load of Ukraine war on Europe and European countries, which is something that people didn't vote for. But I mean, I'm over in New Zealand at the moment, and it's been very interesting here chatting with people about the election. I mean, I know you say, Martin, that Jacinda was returned with a great majority. Well, of course, if she wasn't, the National Party, which is their kind of Tory party, did get more votes and more seats than the Labour Party, Jacinda's party. So she got a resounding...
She got more than 50% of the vote, Tony.
No, what happened is she went into coalition with the Greens here.
No, so she didn't need to go into coalition with the Greens. She chose to do that. They could have fought on their own.
They have a smaller party than the Greens. But anyway, this is what I've been being told, Martin. Let's not have a big row about this. We can have a look at that if you want, and look at it properly and find out what's the actual facts behind it. But anyway, in the meantime, I mean, I think it's quite interesting because of the vaccine pass they had here, and people were saying, well, if people hadn't been fully vaccinated, they couldn't do loads of things like They couldn't go to cafes, they couldn't go to restaurants, they couldn't go to government buildings. There is now a big resentment about that, they felt was over the top. So I'm connecting this really up with Rishi Sunak and his attempts to have ID cards, vaccine passes, social credit, basically a little tag on every single individual, which says whether you're allowed to be a normal citizen or not, which was sort of what we fought years ago with ID cards under Gordon Brown and the Labour Party before the 2010 election. Right. So let's have a listen now to Matthew Ty. I had a look recently we've got to understand what is this social credit system, especially if Rishi is quietly trying to make a fortune implementing it for an international elite of banksters. Let's have a look at what it is. So this is a clip by Matthew Ty from his excellent, I don't really know much about him. He does something called Laowhy86, Laowhy86. He's a US, I suppose you'd call him a journalist, really. I mean, he's just putting together information about these things as to how does China's social credit system actually work.
I actually found the framework and the documents used by the Chinese government to roll out their social credit system. So keep in mind, this is how the social credit system is being experimented with, and then eventually how it was rolled out to other areas. So this is in its purest form. The government basically divvied out 1,000 points to its citizens, and they're kept by local Communist Party officials. This is their baseline. So you can either go above 1,000 or you can go below 1,000. But basically, before we talk about what gives and takes away points, I want to tell you guys how their tier system works. So it's very ironic that in China, a communist country, people are rated based on their credit worthiness, right? So they have this tier system, a caste system, basically, that puts people really high up or really low. The highest tier is called AAA. Of course, that is the best. It is called model of credit worthiness. If you have 1,050 points or higher, so this means you went above the baseline, you get some benefits, right? The second tier is called AA, or exceptional credit worthiness. This is basically the same benefits of AAA. There's no difference, but I'm feeling like if you're missing that extra A, if you're just a AA, I would feel super subpar to my neighbor. If he's a AAA, I'm only a AA, but then I'd probably throw in like an excuse related to battery size to like make myself feel better. Anyway, the next level is the A credit worthiness. And this one comes in three different flavors. You get A+, A, and A-. So this is when you're kind of hovering around, you know, what they divvied out in the beginning. These are your benefits. You get to be entered on a list to be used as a model in publicity. So you give the ability to the government to use you as a model citizen for publicity. Wow, awesome. You get priority in school enrollment and other social assistance. So this is scary. This is a few Chinese social programs that they actually have. You have to be an A to kind of get priority assistance for these things. And school enrollment is supposed to be completely non-competitive in terms of what schools you go to outside of your grades. So now it's changing to that if you are not a good model citizen, your kids don't get to go to good schools, which is terrifying. You get preferential care and employment, social assistance, and you get preference over equally qualified competitors in promotion or retention. So this is in jobs and work and things like this. And by the way, I'm not talking about some like secret speculation. These are the official documents that say this. If you're an A, you get treated as a better person. Next is relatively credit worthy. So that's when you've dipped below 1,000, right? You're locked into it for 2 years. And what happens now is if you're in a B tier, you're probably going to get lectures and visits from the government officials, and they're going to tell you how you can improve your score, right? But you're going to be locked in there in like probation for 2 years. Now, when you drop down to a C, when you're at like 600 to 849 points, you're locked in there for 3 years before you can move up to a B even. more visits from officials. They're going to be watching you, making sure you're on good behavior. They're going to be scrutinizing you in daily life. You're going to be on a list now. Now, this list won't go to the full public with all of your information, address, age, what you did wrong, blah, blah, blah. But it will go to other government officials. So they said it will go to a limited audience. When you drop to the lowest tier, and this is D, this is called not creditworthy. It basically, it's like if you talk about Indian caste system, it's the untouchables. You're locked into level D for 5 years, right? So this is, when you're locked into D, you're talking about the officials are coming to visit you all the time. They can cancel any government funding that you have. So not just temporarily suspend it. We're talking about canceling the government subsidies. You go on a blacklist, and this is public. All Ds will go public. So publicly disclosing the information on their untrustworthiness. They can revoke all of your titles. So if you had a PhD or scientific discoveries, you'll have that erased, right? You can't get a loan, and you can actually lose your job over this. So if it's tied to what happened, like what you did to be untrustworthy, according to the government, they can actually completely get rid of your qualifications and actually strip away your job. So you're locked into there for 5 years. But what you have to understand is that there's all kinds of direct judgment factors. So The Chinese government actually says if you commit an intentional crime, right, this brings you to the bottom of D. It's not like some sort of sliding scale here. If you went out there and did something bad on purpose, you just straight go down to D. But let me make one thing super clear. If you are a political dissident or you speak out against the government, you're screwed either way. The Communist Party of China will just lock you up or disappear you, okay? This is not a country with a rule of law. This is more of a system to coerce and influence future behavior and to standardize it for greater and ultimate control over the population. So now that you know all these tiers, right, I actually wanted to break down and make it super easy on some of the ways you can gain or lose them. Now there's like a thousand different ways you can gain or lose points, but I'll highlight some random ones. And what I want to do is take the average Joe, and I mean Z-H-O-U, and we're going to make two of them. We're going to make Hao Joe and we're going to make Huai Joe. And how means good and why means bad. And they're both going to start with 1,000 points. And we're going to go through some of the things that they're going to do good and some of the things that they'll do bad with the same baseline to see where they end up. If you overdraft on your credit card or your bank, minus 10 points. If you return lost money, we're talking 10,000 RMB or more. And this is probably returning lost money to the government, by the way. If you just somehow come across it, that's not leading people to scams at all. That's plus 10 points. If you use WeChat, forums, blogs, or other internet technology, so just the internet, to publish and transmit negative information, that's minus 50. And that's just negative. That's negative information about the government. If you disseminate false speech, incitement, or cause trouble on WeChat groups, however, so not like person to person, that's minus 30. So sending a message literally on social media can knock you down minus 50. And if you do it in a WeChat group, that's minus 30.
Right, so that's a bit of detail about how this social credit system works in China. Is there any way you actually approve of doing this kind of thing, Martin? Because it seems like a kind of technocratic way of, it's somewhere between slavery and farming people.
Well, if you look at the history of modern history of China, you'll see that in the Cultural Revolution, millions of people were sent to the countryside with no appeal. Xi Jinping was one of them. As a teenager or 20-something, he was sent to the countryside as a punishment. And in actual fact, millions of people died in famines, which were caused by the government in China. So, but people focusing on the technological aspects of this are rather missing the point. China has always been a communist dictatorship since 1949.
And it's not communist now, surely. I mean, it's a capitalist country.
No, the banks, as you just pointed out, the banks are still owned by the government. So, for example, the social credit system is often used and prominently used to discipline billionaires like Jack Ma, who tried to set up a fintech company, which was supposedly a tech company, but was in fact a bank. And the authorities moved in and stopped him doing that. Fintech, of course, was what David Cameron was involved in here, where he hoped to make £20 million from being a shareholder in this fintech company. And of course, that's the sort of thing that's perfectly allowed over here in China.
Martin, it isn't allowed. I mean, what about happened to Roman Abramovich? We get the super rich in London are also targeted and punished.
Well, Roman Abramovich has been targeted by the Britons. because he's supposedly pro-Putin.
If they're not part of the clique.
Well, yes, and all countries, including Britain, like Abramovich has done nothing illegal in Britain, but he's pro-Putin, or that's how he's perceived. Therefore, he can be punished by the British authorities.
Yeah, I mean,
disciplinary systems.
Well, this is what China's I'm saying. That both China and the UK, including most of the Western countries, obviously, are being run by cliques. But one of the interesting things that he puts in that report there, and I'll put a link to the full report up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to one of our listeners for sending that in. It's very interesting. It's actually going into a bit of detail, which we don't get enough of the detail generally, is this whole idea of coercion. And it seems to me, I mean, what through COVID, et cetera, that there is a very, very close, like with the Nudge Unit, people like this, attention to detail by our governments now, and obviously by the big corporations that are behind them, in coercing populations to do X, Y, and Z. Now, that means, of course, that some of the, first of all, it means propaganda, that is to say, the mass media, consistently lying. And being bribed by corporations and governments to take a particular line and not being at all independent, is this thing called the Chart of Coercion, which Ian Jenkins over in Merthyr Tydfil posted this week, which is I found absolutely fascinating. You know what it's used for, Martin? It's used for working out, if someone is being domestically abused or not, and the extent to which they are. But this whole idea of coercion in Biderman's Chart of Coercion, I mean, it talks about things like isolating people, controlling or distorting perception of people, humiliation, degradation, threats, enforcing trivial demands, exhausting people, allowing them occasional indulgences of little bits of freedom. I mean, it's a fascinating thing that I think to look at the way that whether somebody is causing domestic abuse can actually be used to see whether your government is gaslighting you effectively.
Well, governments throughout history have been involved in doing these kinds of things. The new technologies allow them more scope to do these kind of things. But the question is, what's the ultimate motivation behind it all? There hasn't been a mass famine in China since the 1950s. And the Cultural Revolution, where thousands and millions of people were persecuted. Modern China is, in fact, more open, democratic, inverted commas, than previous regimes in China since 1949. They're using this technology to control people. In the past, the technology wasn't there. They used to come round to your house and beat you up.
Also, I think it was a bit unfair of Matthew there to say that it's a lawless society. It's just that the laws are very different. I mean, they're not. They give all power to the Chinese Communist Party and the social credit system, and very little to any individual that thinks, well, this isn't very good. We want to change things and do things differently. Well, you can certainly try that. You're not going to get very far. But anyway, so Biderman's Chart of Coercion, it's quite, I can't read the whole thing out, but I've given you a taste of it. I'll put a copy of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Anything else to say about Rishi before we move on to look at Jeremy Hunt?
Well, I mean, Rishi Sunak, as we say, he's very much a part of the global elite. If he hadn't got into politics in Britain, he'd probably be back in California, in Silicon Valley, or in India. So he's very much somebody who's embedded within those circles.
And Goldman Sachs is his former employer. I mean, isn't it a bit like MI6? You don't leave Goldman Sachs.
Well, Goldman Sachs, of course, was a hedge fund, which in the 2008 crisis was reclassified as a bank so that it could be bailed out by the taxpayer. And in actual fact, if the banks had been allowed to crash and Goldman Sachs wasn't even a bank, it was a hedge fund, then Rishi Sunak might be worth zero. And in a social credit system like in China, maybe be going down the dole. But of course, he isn't. He's a prime minister.
Well, let's see how long he lasts. Do you think he'll last a bit longer than the last couple?
Well, it wouldn't be. Liz Truss only lasted 43 days, so it'd be surprising if he didn't manage that. But there's trouble ahead because they've promised too many different things to too many different factions within the Tory party, and they can't square the circle. Nor, of course, have they got, at some point, that there's going to be a rebellion because the economy is going to tank. And I don't think he's got any solutions for any of that.
I will put a link to Peter Oborne's wonderful demolition of Liz Truss. I mean, it's a bit, I don't think there's much point in listening to it now because, of course, she's history. But he did, I think, a terrific job in, you know, it's one of the only really honest, decent, freelance, independent-minded journalists in the UK at the moment. He was also a figure in the Labour Files, the Al Jazeera programme. And I noticed also that on Squawk Box, the left-wing Labour, pro-Labour socialist blog, was saying, showing, in fact, giving an example of somebody phoning up LBC, the big radio station in London, chatting away, and then as soon as they mentioned the Labour Files by Al Jazeera, they managed to get the word Labour Files, Al Jazeera out, and then immediately were just cut off in their, you know, there is a real resentment, Martin, isn't there, don't you think, about the British in the London press about Al Jazeera doing this expose of the right wing in the Tory party.
Well, yes. And of course, it was John Ware's Panorama programme, which we had some clips on in previous weeks, which was a hatchet job on Jeremy Corbyn by what were essentially employees of the or ex-employees of the Israeli embassy. And of course, it was put out on BBC, which is supposedly impartial. But of course, lots of things aren't impartial. The Daily Mail isn't impartial. Mm. Daily Telegraph isn't impartial. Well, the show isn't entirely impartial, is it?
Well, the point being that John Ware was basically smuggling these ex-Israeli embassy employees in as if they were independent-minded, and he wasn't giving the balanced view to the other side. That is, I think, isn't it Jewish Voice for Labour, Martin?
Well, Jewish Voice for Labour has just been persecuted relentlessly by the hierarchy within the Labour Party and, of course, within the mainstream press, including the BBC.
People might think that there is a Zionist conspiracy here. I mean, this is the sort of thing you're not supposed to say, but it does look as if there is, there are Zionist influences within the BBC, which are pro, you know, the pro-Israeli state influence is incredibly strong. And even if one of our main political parties is being infiltrated and undermined by a pro-Israeli faction from the Israeli embassy, that you're not going to get any reports on it because they're also in the BBC controlling the narrative.
Well, that's right. And it's not just the Labour Party, of course. Conservative Friends of Israel, very powerful. I mean, Liz Truss was talking about moving the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Although I see that the left-wing government in Australia, the previous Morrison government, the right-wing government, had gone along with Truss's manoeuvring and moved the Australian embassy to Jerusalem. But the new administration has moved it back to Tel Aviv. So this is, you know, all of these things are still bubbling away.
Okay, well, let's have a look at Jeremy Hunt then. God, what a shower this lot are. I don't know if you saw the Guardian piece about his charity he set up, Martin. By the way, you're absolutely right about the New Zealand Parliament. Sorry, I'm obviously just picking it up from people chatting away here. The New Zealand Labour Party has 64 members of Parliament. The Green Party has 10. The National Party, which is their kind of Tory party here, has 33. So that's roughly half as many as the Labour Party. And they've got something called the Maori Party with 2 and the ACT Party with 10. It's interesting. You know, I'm getting this from them. They're saying, oh, no. Maybe they're, you know, sort of conning themselves. Maybe it's electoral. Oh, hang on. It's electoral seats. Yeah, is it? No. 19 from the party list and 45 electoral seats. So they've got some sort of system here with a party list and electoral seats. Can you explain that, Martin?
I think the technical term for it is a D'Hondt PR system, where some people are elected by constituencies and then the people on the party list are added to that to make sure that the votes represent the actual voting of the population. So the National Party didn't do very well at the last election in New Zealand. They pushed your line, the line about, you know, we think there was too much lockdown, too much vaccine control, and it didn't go down at all well with the population. The National Party now are coming back And there's going to be an election quite soon in New Zealand. And are they going to do better than they did then? But they didn't do very well at the last election, because basically people thought Jacinda had done quite a good job. But I mean, whether rightly or wrongly, that's what the perception was.
That's what they think. Yeah. Well, so, yeah, sorry about that. You're absolutely right. My little chit chats in the street here are wrong. And that people do that a lot more here, let me just say. People are very, very – they're not rushing about so much. I mean, obviously, they wouldn't do it in one of the big cities, and we're quite, you know, fairly rural here. But people do seem to have – there's a lot of retirees around. You know, there's a lot more kind of interaction in the street, I find. Also, I suppose the weather helps, doesn't it? But there was a big protest here the week I came out last week, which is – but was by the farmers, and they are what they're doing here is very similar to what's going on in Holland. In other words, the farmers are basically being told, unless you wind down your livestock production, you're not going to be able to make money as a farmer. Now that, you know, this is the no livestock idea. I mean, this has not gone down like a lead balloon, and a lot of the population also, I think, because farming, just trying to sum up what sort of makes New Zealand is you've got three main sort of industries. One is construction, including fixing the roads, because the roads are always, you know, getting these things called slips, where the rock slips down on the road and blocks the road. In the rain, basically, and construction. Then you've also got tourism and farming are the three main big things over here. And so the farmers did protests all over the country, going into all the major cities. And they weren't really blocking anything last week, but they were just making their presence felt, saying, "No, you're not going to do this." What's behind this? This idea of, is it really about climate change? This idea, Martin, of stopping farmers from farming sheep and cattle and that sort of thing?
Well, there is a climate change argument that methane production by cows is a major, you know, that's the New Zealand's main contribution to global, methane, if global warming exists and so on. What was happening in Holland was they wanted to get rid of nitrogen fertilizer. Now, nitrogen fertilizer is, in fact, potentially...
Yeah, but they're doing the same here. Yeah, that's what another thing they're saying.
It's potentially carcinogenic. So you can see why people might say, well, we don't want to be using all sorts.
Yeah, it's very much like the energy thing, isn't it, for the general population, is that people have got hooked on doing this. I mean, there was very little use of fertilizer before, really, around the time of the Second World War. It really ramped up after the World War II. But, you know, most farmers used to use, cattle dung to fertilize the lands, spraying slurry around, and that was seen to be the most simple way of doing it, because you're producing the stuff on the farm, and then suddenly cheap energy, cheap fertilizer, let's do it this way. And now people have kind of got used to that, and they kind of need that fertilizer in order to make the farm economic. People are being kind of pushed around. Anyway, sorry, I got diverted a little bit there. I think it's useful to kind of look at what's going on in New Zealand as well occasionally, since I'm over here. I may as well share that. And also, they're saying here, this has never been done before. Well, of course, it is being done in Holland too. But anyway, Jeremy Hunt's charity. He's our wonderful Chancellor. He's had a bit of a checkered past as a sort of somebody who has been constantly kind of doing awful things including in the privatising the National Health Service as Health Secretary, and then kind of elbowed out because he doesn't really seem to have any credibility left. And now he's back as Chancellor. His charity, founded by Jeremy Hunt, paid 66% of its income to the Chief Executive, Patient Safety Watch. So he's, you know, he's just setting up health charities. His former advisor, Adam Smith, made him more than £110,000 in the year to January. A charity founded by the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, paid more than £110,000, two-thirds of its income, to his former political advisor, Adam Smith, who lost his job over a lobbying scandal. Patient Safety Watch, which was set up to research preventable harm in healthcare, paid Smith, as its sole employee and chief executive, around 66% of its income in the year ending January 2022. Now, this clearly is not a charity. It should be struck off if it's paying most of its income, two-thirds of it, to as a massive fee to one of Hunt's former advisors, Martin.
Well, I mean, this kind of sleaze and backhanding has become endemic within the Conservative Party in this country, hasn't it? Think of all the money wasted on Test and Trace and Dido Harding. It's just, you know, it's almost like we've got so used to it now, it's hardly worth mentioning.
Well, it was established in 2019, this charity, to conduct research, says The Guardian, but appears to have produced no papers since then. A message on its website says, "We have an ambitious research program looking into a wide variety of patient safety issues. We will publish details of our forthcoming research on these pages." But 3 years later, nothing. The page says, "Our reports will be published here. Please check back soon for our first piece of research." I mean, this is a sort of Mickey take, really, isn't it? And it's it's appalling to think what Hunt might be up to as Chancellor, in charge of all of the taxpayers' money, when we can see he's setting up these little slush funds for people, basically under the guise of a charity. I'm just amazed that the Charity Commission is so utterly useless and pathetic as to allow someone to set up a charity that's supposed to be doing something, where actually the money is just simply being funneled into the pockets of whoever set it up.
Well, the Adam Smith Institute and the Institute for Economic Affairs, they are all charitable, but of course they won't tell you where they get their money from, because it's a secret. And they are very, very, they were very, very influential in the Liz Truss government. Loads of their people were put in power, in positions of power, some of whom now presumably have been removed. But I mean, this kind of thing is the norm in Britain, and the norm in the United States of America even more so. And, you know, democracy is a very, denuded thing in both of these countries.
Well, there isn't really any left, is there? I mean, very, very little. And it's only what I suppose the press lets them get away with. I see also, going back to Rishi, an article from last year. Rishi Sunak plans to introduce an official digital currency to rival cash in the biggest upheaval in the monetary system for centuries. The Bank of England would establish a direct digital equivalent to physical money. Supporters say the move will give the economy a boost during a financial crisis, and could slash cost and time it takes to make payments online and transfer money. What do you make of this whole, you know, digital currency, Martin? Because it is obviously much, much more convenient just to wave a little, credit card or debit card and go bip, rather than hand over cash and to, you know, check your change, etc. Bip, bip, bip is a lot easier and a lot quicker, isn't it?
Well, that's the argument in favour of it. Obviously, there are other arguments against it. Don't forget that, was it Rishi Sunak? I'm trying to think now. The fintech company that Cameron was involved in, what they did is they managed to worm their way in and say, we will pay all NHS wages, and then you pay us so that we can get the money out to people quickly, and then the government will pay us and give us a premium for doing that. Now, there was no case whatsoever for the government to give that private sector the job of paying NHS wages. And on the back of that, of course, it went bust in the end, and Cameron was caught with his pants down. But he stood to make £20 million out of that using his connections. And he lobbied Rishi Sunak, who was then the Chancellor, to allow this to take place. Now, you can see that if you have got people in power who are already, you know, embedded within these kind of financial technology companies, that they're going to try and pull everything they can out of the hat in order to keep that money flowing in the directions they want it to flow in. The Bitcoin and all the other electronic currencies were originally perceived as a way of escaping from state control. But of course, Bitcoin has crashed, and But what is happening, of course, is in China, they are developing a digital currency to be administered by the state. So
it seems like the deal is that you can have this nice, easy, convenient digital currency so long as we can track everything you do and switch it off whenever we feel like it.
Yes, but as I said before, China has always been an authoritarian state. Even before digital currencies and all the rest of it, you know, your neighbourhood Communist Party official would make sure that you did as you were told, or else. And that, you know, that's just been the norm for many decades.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen. I've got a couple of clips this week. One is from Guy Hands, and the other one is from Jamie Jenkins. They're both of them. Guy Hands is the bloke who owns Annington Homes, and this is a story we've reported on over the last 6 months or so, which is the Ministry of Defence housing crisis. Well, I say it's a crisis. There's many thousands of homes built by the Ministry of Defence, which the John Major government privatised into this Guy Hands's hands. This guy's hands. You can't say these things, really. That is, you know, that's ridiculous, isn't it? But anyway, easy way to remember his name, I suppose. Back in the 1990s. And then he is now leasing. I mean, these are the sort of owners of the infrastructure, right? Military infrastructure, amazingly. Of course, he might just decide he wants to sell this to the Chinese, I suppose, and let them own all our Ministry of Defence housing. He is talking about what he thinks has been going on economically with Truss. And this is before the announcement of Truss going and Sunak arriving, it's at the beginning of this week. And he's saying here, look, this is the situation in the wider global economy. And this is the disaster that Liz Truss has been creating here.
And the reality is that when they did Brexit, they had a dream, and the dream was low tax, low benefit economy. Truss, to be fair to her, tried it. It clearly isn't something that's acceptable to the British people. The British people have never voted or even shown any inclination to vote for the sort of extreme Thatcherism that Brexit needed. Once you accept that you can't actually do that, then the Brexit that was done is completely hopeless and will only drive Britain into a disastrous economic state. So I think if the Tory party can own up to the mistake they made and how they negotiated Brexit and have somebody leading it who actually has the intellectual capability and the authority to renegotiate Brexit, there is a possibility of turning around the economy. But without that, the economy is frankly doomed.
What does that mean for households, for businesses in the UK, if you say the economy is doomed?
Steadily increasing taxes, steadily reducing benefits and social services, higher interest rates, and eventually the need for a bailout from the IMF like we were in the 70s.
Yeah, so it was quite interesting to hear, and thanks for one of our correspondents for pointing that out, that, you know, to hear Guy Hands popping up on the Today programme. He's this multi-billionaire who now owns all this property that he's trying to evict people, apparently, according to the Daily Mail, to put Ukrainians into these houses. So even some military personnel who are living in these Ministry of Defence houses, he's trying to boot them out to fill them up with, well, whether it's Ukrainians. And let me just say that talking to some of the residents in Devizes, in the houses in the centre of Devizes, which are something like 85% empty, there's only a few people left that they were threatening to evict. They're not actually evicting them yet, but they were telling me exactly this. We think that they might be wanting to put Ukrainians in here. And I'm thinking to myself, really? Are you sure? Well, it comes out in the national press a few weeks later. Yes, they are. And this is Guy Hands for you. Anyway, Martin, he's trying to blame our economic woes on Brexit there. But, of course, many other countries in Europe are experiencing similar. I mean, the Germans are really worried about basically a kind of industrial collapse over there.
Yeah, well, I think he's actually, it's hard to unpick what his actual views there are. You know, it's some people in the Brexit camp still think that we haven't done Brexit properly, etc. And of course, that's not where the general public opinion has moved. We saw the potential collapse of the Northern Ireland situation this week. We're probably going to have another election in Northern Ireland, which will then, of course, the Democratic Unionist Party will then refuse to form a government.
Because I missed that. Can you explain what's happened?
Well, as you know, because of the decision to leave the single market and the customs union, if we'd stayed in the single market or the customs union, there wouldn't need to be any kind of border anywhere. But because of the, you know, if we're going to do Brexit, we've got to leave the single market and the customs union, then there has to be a border somewhere in Ireland. And that was what the debate was all about. It was a rerunning of the Irish question, which has dominated British politics, in fact, for the last 200 years.
Yeah, but what's happened this week?
Well, what's happened this week is that the deadline was passed today for the Democratic Unionist Party to form, to agree to form a government after the last election in May. And they refused to do it. All the other parties were happy to form a government, including with them in it. But they said they didn't want to be in it, and that they want the agreement, which is the Brexit agreement with the Irish and the rest of the EU, ripped up. Now, they're a minority even within Northern Ireland. And there's certainly a minority within Ireland and a minority within Britain, because most people in Britain don't care whether there is a border in the Irish Sea or not. You can be quite sure that people in Newcastle just don't care about that.
The obvious solution to this is to have a referendum on the reunification of Ireland, isn't it?
No, because you haven't got sufficient majority for that. The Alliance Party have done rather well in recent elections in Northern Ireland, and they are not necessarily in favour of a united Ireland.
Oh, dear.
So, in other words... You can't get around it by that doing that. I mean, why really, the deal is done.
What is Rishi going to do about this, do you think?
Well, one of the problems he will find is if he does, the right wing of his own party will side with the DUP, you know, the Jacob Rees-Mogg and so forth.
Well, the Conservative and Unionist Party, of course, yeah.
Well, they will, but they're a minority in Britain, and they're a minority in the north of Ireland, and a minority in Ireland. So it could well be that we are going to end up in a trade war with our nearest neighbours because of this refusal to accept the deal that's already been done by Boris Johnson, which agreed that there was going to be a border in the Irish Sea.
A fudge during the old Brexit thing. But anyway, look, let's have a listen now to Nick Simon. He runs a website up in Nottingham. He's a Conservative who's not at all happy about Rishi Sunak being appointed. Nick, he thinks that the whole thing is basically a plot to bring down Boris. So let's have a listen to him now.
The destabilising of Boris Johnson was really brought about by the fact that Remainers in the party and the establishment and the media would never forgive him for seeing through Brexit as far as he could. And I think the worry is that there is kind of a Ramona plot, that the narrative being first get rid of Boris, then destabilise the party, and then get somebody in that's from the moderate side, and then push for rejoining the single market. So, that's the worry, and I can see a hell of a lot of evidence for it. And I was at a Conservative meeting the other night where one of the guys got up and basically said to an MP, he listed the things that led to Boris Johnson's departure. And they really were incredibly petty. When a Prime Minister's in office and he's incredibly busy and under incredible strain, he's not going to be micromanaging his staff and telling them, don't arrange drinks parties after work. It really is beyond ridiculous that he could have been blamed for that. And I just think they brought him down for the most ridiculous, petty reasons that you would never bring a Prime Minister. I remember at the time, I posted on my Facebook group that some people have got short memories. If you remember when Theresa May was brought down, she was basically on the verge of bringing down Brexit. She was going against the will of the people in a democratic referendum, and she was trying to force us down the route of a Brino, a Brexit in name only. It was a really, really serious situation, and if you compare that with a few office drinks in, you know, in 10 Downing Street, and then a Conservative MP kind of groping somebody in the Carlton Club. You know, I mean, I felt at the time that Theresa May had to be brought down, but I thought the way they brought Boris down was beyond farcical. And it does worry that it was, you know, basically a Remainer plot to bring Boris down.
Yeah, a Remainer plot to bring Boris down, apparently, Martin.
Well, it's a lot of self-delusion, isn't it? What really brought down Boris Johnson was Owen Paterson, who was actually refusing to explain his his non-parliamentary expenditure. You know, he was basically doing loads of work.
It's nothing to do with Goldman Sachs and the city behind the scenes.
Well, no, Goldman Sachs and the city.
Deciding, right, we're going to turn. Martin, we're going to turn Britain into a technocratic country like the rest of Europe.
No, Tony, it's not. Crispin Odie, who's a major hedge fund manager, who actually funded most of the Leave campaign, he was the biggest contributor to it, he said about shorting British government gilts in the last couple of weeks, he said, well, it's just the gift that keeps on giving. So we're making loads of money out of this crisis. Ultimately, we're probably going to have to go back into the single market, because we will, because that's the obvious way for us to go. Being outside the single market means we've got the power to have a different size screws than everybody else in Europe. And of course, all the countries in Europe in the single market, including Switzerland, Norway and Iceland, we're the only ones that aren't. And of course, Northern Ireland has actually done rather better in the crisis than any other region of the UK because it's still in the single market.
Okay.
And ultimately, that penny's going to drop in Newcastle.
Martin, Nick and some of his Conservative group are, you know, think the opposite of that, but he also talked to me about his thoughts on this whole idea of the cashless society we were talking about with Rishi Sunak earlier.
It is deeply worrying. I mean, I've seen programs about China and their education system, and it does all seem to be extremely harsh and controlling. I mean, I'm very much a libertarian. I even don't like the fact that, you know, since the pandemic and the end of the pandemic, you still go into certain bars and clubs and things and they won't accept cash. So I'm even annoyed about that, let alone a bigger digital currency kind of 1980s.
Yeah, well, I think
I'm not sure entirely how legal it is to not accept cash. It is legal tender after all.
I'll put the full version of this interview with Nick Simon up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But his main point, Martin, which would be interesting, you know, let you address when he finishes here, is that he's saying Brexit, what Brexit?
We haven't taken advantage of the opportunities of Brexit at all. I mean, we've struggled to get out of EU regulation. We haven't done that. We've still got part of our sovereign territory, Northern Ireland, that's kind of in the customs area. And somebody said, that was much cleverer than me, said no country anywhere in the world would accept part of their sovereignty being regulated by a foreign power, as we do in Northern Ireland. And the thing that nobody can accept is the EU is a foreign power. We're no longer in the EU. So they shouldn't be regulating in Northern Ireland. So, I mean, you know, that's a big stumbling block that needs to be resolved, and this government needs to show some mettle that they're going to sort it out. I hope they do it by the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. They're still talking about agreeing a deal with the EU, which makes me want to put my head in my hands because it's never going to happen. But, yeah, overall, I mean, Brexit could have made us very much more profitable and very much more, on a global trader had we took the opportunities of it. But I think Boris Johnson made mistakes, but I think also he was a bit sidelined by the fact that as soon as we had Brexit, we got thrown into COVID, and then there was this lockdown, which was so incredibly damaging to the economy, and it appears now that most people are actually openly accepting that lockdown was a mistake, could have been handled in a different way. So that put us back, and then obviously the war in Europe and the energy prices. So I really don't think Brexit has had a chance to fulfil itself yet. But we really must get this Northern Ireland situation sorted out.
Yeah,
and that will be a test of Sunak, because if he doesn't do it, you know, he'll be gone.
I think it was the one of the von Habsburgs, who's the boss of the Pan-European Union based in Munich, during Brexit, he said it's actually quite entertaining watching the Brits try to leave because they'll never manage it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but I remember at the time, I remember there was a European Union official from Finland. I could tell he was from Finland because of his accent. Can't remember his name. But he kept saying all this talk about Brexit. There is no mechanism to leave. There is no way to leave. And he repeated it time and time and time again. But that's the situation that they've managed to get, for example, Italy in. Any country that's in the euro, it is impossible for them to leave. It is impossible for them to extricate themselves from, unless they have a complete banking crisis and their economy collapses, in which case they may have to dump the euro. They may be forced to dump the euro and relaunch their own currency. But if they were forced into that, you know, it would be a Europe-wide economic collapse that, you know, brought it about.
So what do you make of his last point there, Martin?
Well, there's probably going to be a Europe-wide economic collapse anyway, because of the capitalist system as a whole is in crisis, and the war in the Ukraine has led to a huge spike in energy prices. And of course, he didn't mention there the blowing up of the Russian pipelines. That's the real world.
Now,
the
real world. I don't believe I just heard you say that the war has led to a spike in energy prices.
No, only because of the sanctions on Russia. Yeah, that's what's caused
because
it.
It's not really
the Americans having.
Yeah, the cause is not the war. The cause is the response to the war.
That's right. And Britain now is very much in the US camp of trying to force the Germans not to do deals with the Russians. But, of course, the Germans would be wise to take no notice.
Blowing up pipelines that where they might decide they want to do deals, making sure that they can't. Is there any more news on what was behind that Nord Stream 2? I've seen some people saying that it was the Swedes behind it. Any more news? Because obviously Nord Stream 2
was
a serious act of war, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, of course, most of the rest of the world, including Russia, have drawn the correct conclusions about who did it. And, of course, Britain is playing the role of sabotaging German policy, and the Germans ought to be aware of that. All this delusion about what we need is to get rid of regulations in Britain and then we'll be more prosperous, that's just pure Thatcherism. In actual fact, the single market, even if the EU collapses and the euro collapses, the single market will remain because it's embedded in micro decisions by small companies about the size of screws. And you can't opt out of that. If you want to sell your stuff to the Europeans, you've got to use the same size of screws as they do. Otherwise, they're not going to buy it. And that's always been the issue, where our major trading partners are like the Ireland, which is our nearest partner. In fact, we do more trade with Ireland than we do with China. But we're not. And of course, issue.
I would say we no. Hang on, we must import.
No, because it's because Northern Ireland is embedded within the Irish economy. So everything that crosses that border is international trade.
In terms of Northern Ireland, okay.
Yes.
Anyway,
yes.
That's Nick Simon. I'll put the link up to the full interview with him if you're interested. He's based in Nottingham. He's got a Facebook group which he talks about on the full interview. And if you're interested, you can follow that there. Anyway, we're joined in the studio, I believe, by Farouk Sadiq. Hi, Farouk, are you there?
Hi, Tony, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Lovely to hear you, boys. And before we talk, we're going to be talking with you after the break about Pakistan. Mm-hmm. But I hope you're able to join us to talk a little bit about Rishi, our new prime minister. Is that okay?
Yeah, it should be fine, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's from, should I say, your part of the world, although, of course, you are a Brit. Mm. You know, you are representing the Pakistan Association.
Sure.
In Bristol. And what do you make of him? I mean, we've been talking about him as somebody who's involved in the social credit, a big social credit company over in India, as well as wanting to introduce digital currencies here in the UK. So he's not just, isn't it interesting to have a South Asian prime minister for the first time, but he's got a bit of a finance and social credit agenda that comes with him.
Mm. Well, I mean, to be fair, there is a section of the Asian community that is obviously touched by this. It's a poignant moment in terms of the history of the Raj and everything. But at the same time, I have to say, when the colonial era existed, it was people who sold their communities out that enabled the Raj to actually take place. So they were the people that felt had to be whiter than white, if you see what I mean, to be accepted by the colonial powers. And some sections of our community, because his grandparents, he actually hails from Gujranwala, which is actually in Pakistan, and he left India before it became independent. He moved to Kenya, where his parents did. So in terms of the Asian ancestry, I know a lot of Indian media is very practicing devout Hindu, occupying number 10 Downing Street, and there is a lot to say about that. I mean, that is, as I said, it's a poignant moment. But at the same time, his background is anything but the typical South Asian background. It's a very privileged background. He's actually the perfect Tory, if you like. I remember you've probably seen that video of him where he says, you know, I've got friends from all places, including working class, and then you have to backtrack from that. So he's obviously lived a very privileged life, and he's only joined politics in 2015. And suddenly, you know, 7 years later, he's the leading politician in the country. He's the head of the country.
Yeah, so. I do wonder whether he's still got a sort of mobile number of some of the people in Goldman Sachs, and maybe he listens to them more than he does your average Joe in the street. Anyway, we're going to have a listen now with Martin to Prime Minister's questions, his first one. Liz Truss, and I'll put a little picture up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. She only managed three Prime Minister's questions before she was out. So let's see how Sunak and Starmer get on together at Prime Minister's questions this week.
In public, he claims he wants to level up the North, but then he boasts about trying to funnel vital investment away from deprived areas. He says one thing and does another. But they're shouting. They're not my words. They're not my words. They're the words of the former chair of the Tory party, sacked yesterday for telling the truth about the Prime Minister. Even his own side know he's not on the side of working people. That's why the only time he ran in a competitive election, he got trounced by the former Prime Minister, who herself got beaten by a lettuce. So why doesn't he put it to the test, let working people have their say, and call a general election?
Well, it'll take a long time to get through this paper if we carry on like this, Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, he talks about mandates, about votes, about elections. It's a bit rich coming from the person who tried to overturn the biggest democratic vote in our country's history. Our mandate is based on a manifesto that we were elected on to remind him an election that we won and they lost. a mandate that says we want a stronger NHS, better schools, safer streets, control of our borders and levelling up. That is the mandate that I and this government will deliver for the British people.
There's not even answer of questions. You want more? Come on, Heather.
Well, yeah, they're shouting more, but don't hold your breath. Is he going to... I mean, this word deliver, they keep using it. So, Martin, what do you make of this exchange here? All politicians have got somewhere on a scale between pomposity and wit. And I think wit works much better in these situations. I see Starmer as he's trying to sort of lord it over all the time without using the wit that he could possibly use in order to undermine Sunak. How do you think he did anyway?
Well, I mean, Sunak's referring to his mandate. The mandate was 43% of the vote at the last election. And in no other European country or South Asian country would that allow you to form a government. We're used to having Tory rule in this country because Tory rule is embedded in the structures of power. And that means that Starmer, of course, in order to try and overturn Tory rule, has to try and work within the structures of power that they've established. But of course, in Northern Ireland and in Ireland, that's not the case. And Britain is very self-referential, very narcissistic. And 57% of people at the last election voted for parties which wanted a second referendum on the EU, but they didn't get their way.
Farouk, Sunak is sticking the knife in. He's saying, well, you tried to overturn the vote in 2016, so who are you to talk?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Sunak is he is an opportunist. I mean, you don't get to rise to power in 7 years from zero to number one in 7 years without being ambitious to the extreme. Just finishing off my point I was talking about earlier, I mean, it's positive that Sunak is in power. I mean, he's certainly more competent than Liz Truss, but then, as you said, Lettuce would be more competent than Liz Truss. But if he gets up there and he throws down the ladder, then there's something to celebrate that people from less privileged backgrounds can go up. But my concern is that he'll actually pull up the drawbridge and say, well, I made it, you know, I'm all right, Jack, kind of stuff. That's my concern. And that's, the jury's out at the moment as to where he is. But if you look at his privileged background and his finance and the people he used to work, the dubious people that he has worked for and hedge fund managers and all that stuff, you can't really hold out much hope. But the only positive is that he's more competent than Liz Truss.
Yes, dear, oh dear. It's sad that we've got to look at the sort of lesser of various evils when we're... I mean, I suppose the same is true in politics in many countries, and various approval ratings of leaders are absolutely hopeless. There's also the fact that so few people turn out and bother to turn out in elections these days, although lots did for Brexit vote. But anyway, look, one of the positive things, at least I see it very positive, is that he's overturned Liz Truss's thing on fracking. So let's listen to the question. I think it's from Caroline Lucas in Brighton, the Green MP, about fracking now.
Caroline Lucas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister's reckless predecessor took a wrecking ball to nature, prompting millions of members of the RSPB, the National Trust, and the Wildlife Trust to rise up in opposition. Yesterday, he promised to fix her mistakes, as well as to uphold the party's 2019 manifesto. So if he is a man of his word, will he start by reversing the green light she gave to fracking, since it's categorically not been shown to be safe, and instead maintain the moratorium that was pledged in that very moratorium, in that very manifesto that he has promised to uphold?
I've already said I stand by the manifesto on that, but what I would say is that I'm proud that this government has passed the landmark Environment Act, putting more protection for the natural environment than we've ever had, with a clear plan to deliver. And I can give the Honourable Lady my commitment that we will deliver on all those ambitions. We will deliver on what we said at COP, because we care deeply about passing our children an environment in better state than we found it ourselves.
Well, it's a bit of a laugh him talking about the Environment Act, whatever that is, because we're seeing more and more building on Greenbelt land than we've ever seen since the Second World War under this government. So I don't know if this Environment Act is going to have any actual effect at all. But Martin, this is quite a big, a U-turn, but fracking is... are they ever going to do it here in the UK? I think, was it a few weeks ago, played a clip from can't remember the name of it, documentary from the States, which showing just how absolutely devastating it is to the environment. Animals dying, people getting sick, inflammable gas coming out of people's, inflammable water coming out of people's taps, all this kind of crazy stuff going on. What do you think that this is this a good decision?
Well, I think the decision to try and go for fracking made by Liz Truss was clearly wrong in every possible way, and not least because they couldn't get it through, and it led directly to her demise. Britain is not a place like the United States where you could do fracking in the middle of nowhere. Anywhere you do it, it's going to be annoying somebody nearby, and lots of Tory MPs from rural areas obviously completely opposed.
Well, it's not just annoying, is it? It's causing earthquakes and poisoning your water table.
Well, also, in the US, it's not really economically viable. It's only viable because of the rigged oil and gas market, which means that that fracking becomes a viable strategy. If there wasn't a rigged oil and gas market internationally, nobody would be fracking because there'd be no point.
I can remember reading, I think it was in, and again, I'm forgetting the name of the book, but it was a book about the scientific war in the Second World War and technological war. It was a bestseller back in the 1980s. And in there, they talk about the Nazis absolutely desperate for energy at the end of the war. They had all their energy supplies cut off, and as they were being slowly surrounded, and they tried. They were then trying fracking. They were trying to get, fuel from shale gas there. It was a sort of last desperate bid. I'll also say it was quite interesting watching the BBC during these Prime Minister's questions at midnight here on Wednesday, and to see the BBC cut off the live coverage of PMQs as soon as Starmer had finished. But actually, Al Jazeera channel carried on the live coverage. So Al Jazeera is doing better coverage of British politics than the BBC. It's not amazing to see that. I was quite shocked and amazed. But also, of course, Prime Minister's questions is not just about Starmer. In fact, much of what he says seems is pretty rubbish to me. A lot of the other MPs are coming up with more interesting things like that fracking question there, Farouk.
I think with Sunak, he seems to be trying to tread a fine line, been trying to keep people on both sides of his party in his support. I mean, he talks about cancelling fracking, and that's a tick for his environmental credentials. But then suddenly he's announced this week, I learned, that he's not attending the COP27 meeting, which is where, where everyone gets together and decides what's going to happen with, the environment around the world. So I'm not quite sure whether the fact that he's in power is going to come to any meaningful decisions for the country that he's basically is trying to hold on to a seat.
Yeah, could be. Also, there was a question about, it annoys me when they cut Prime Minister's questions off, because almost all the interesting stuff goes on later on in PMQs. So it's almost like they're just doing this kind of Tweedledum Tweedledee thing between Starmer and whoever it is this week, and they leave all the interesting stuff. But anyway, Harry Dunn was a young man on his bicycle or motorbike, I think it was, that was mown down by a woman working for or very close to the US intelligence services at a UK base, which is an RAF base, but it isn't really. It's an American Air Force base. And she just drove out of the entrance on the right-hand side, which is the side you drive in the United States, and just killed the guy. And then she hopped on a plane and disappeared off to the United States, trying to avoid justice. And so there was a question at Prime Minister's questions about that to Rishi Sunak.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I sincerely congratulate my right honourable friend and wish him every success. Over 3 years ago, my constituent Harry Dunn was killed in a tragic road accident, and I'd like to ask my right honourable friend to join me in congratulating Harry Dunn's family for the incredible campaign they've run for over 3 years, with huge support from all colleagues across the House, on finally achieving justice for Harry.
Thanks. Well, I pay tribute to my right honourable friend for her role, and indeed the former Foreign Secretary as well, and indeed colleagues from all over the House for the part they've played in bringing about this outcome. My thoughts are obviously with the family, and I join in her sentiments that this is very welcome.
Anne Sekulis pleads guilty to the death of Harry Dunn, but in a way, it's not really justice, is it? She should have been brought back to... she was actually brought back to a London court. Oh, no, she wasn't noticed by a video link. So this is a bit cheeky, Farouk, isn't it?
It is. It reminds me, actually, of exactly the same thing happened in Pakistan a few years back. A CIA operative, Raymond Davis, knocked over somebody while he was drunk and killed a Pakistani vendor, I think he killed. And then he was surrounded by the people who tried to capture him, and then he shot and killed a number of Pakistanis as he escaped to the American embassy. And then straight away he was flown out of the country. And that was a deal done by the Pakistani army as well. They never got justice, but obviously, in this sense here, at least somebody's admitted that a crime took place, although unfortunately no one's actually going to get punished because she doesn't want to step foot in the UK.
No, exactly. So in a way, it's not justice at all. They're saying, oh, this is all closed now, it's finished with, because it's not really. I mean, they've had a campaign. The campaign has simply been a campaign to get her to sit in front of a video camera many, many miles away and say sorry.
That we should be grateful.
I mean, that's not really what one would call justice. Martin, is it?
No, and of course, by agreeing to put her in front of the camera, no doubt they are definitely relying upon the British government to extradite Julian Assange to stand trial under the Espionage Act. Very few people in Parliament are interested in that particular issue, apart from the campaign group of Labour MPs. All the other MPs are, in lockstep in supporting the outrageous demands of the American government in that particular case.
So Anne Sekulis was told to show genuine remorse by voluntarily returning to the UK, but she hasn't done that yet. They're still calling for this. So in a way, the campaign, I suppose, is going to simply go on. Anyway, next at Prime Minister's Questions, there's always interesting stuff in Prime Minister's Questions. I know you, in your slightly curmudgeonly manner, Martin, say, oh, it's just a bit of a sort of Punch and Judy show. Some of the serious stuff is thrashed out there, even if it isn't really dealt with. At least we're getting, some people at the top level discussing these. I mean, you're quite right, the Julian Assange case is far, far more important. And wouldn't it be nice if Julian could just be whisked off somewhere and could answer the questions the Americans have for him via some sort of nice, cosy little video link, and then just stroll off down to the pub afterwards, Anyway, so let's have a listen at Prime Minister's Questions again. This question is on what good old Rishi and Jeremy Hunt are going to be doing with the NHS. Is it going to continue its collapse?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I welcome my right honourable friend's determination to be straight with people about the challenges we face as a country. Last week, the Care Quality Commission State of Care report and State of Care in England showed our health system in gridlock. And I hear the same from my constituents, struggling to see a GP or waiting for treatment. So can I urge him to make unblocking the NHS a priority for him and his health secretary?
So, my honourable friend knows this subject obviously very well from her own experience, and I thank her for the work she did previously in the department. She's absolutely right about the challenge that confronts us. It's why we've put billions of pounds into busting the backlogs and the elective recovery fund, and are delivering funding and staffing to do that. But I look forward to working with her to deliver what we said in our manifesto, and that is a far stronger NHS.
Well, it's easy to say that, but is he, for example, going to stop the privatisation? I wonder, Farouk.
Honestly, I don't believe for one second the Tories, anyone in the Tory party is interested in saving the NHS except to ground it to an absolute screeching halt. I mean, just to give you an example, I think it was 2 weeks ago on Stapleton Road, a man got knocked over, hit and run, and literally about 10 minutes walk from my house. He got knocked over and he was out cold. And the florist lady there, there's a florist there, and she'd called the ambulance. A number of passers-by had called the ambulance. And the ambulance, they responded by saying, "We have got no ambulances available." The guy was out cold. Purely by chance, 10 minutes later, a fire engine was passing. They blocked the roads off. They had first aid, obviously, and they helped. And they stood and they waited until the ambulance arrived. It took the ambulance 45 minutes to get to this young man, who's out cold for, must have been 15, 20 minutes. He was out cold, and he was given treatment. That's an emergency. That's the state of our ambulances. And the ambulance depot, the headquarters, where they come from, is literally 10 minutes away from that site. It's just around the corner.
I mean, I know the other thing is, if it's in the same place as I think it is, it's on a kind of industrial estate, because the central headquarters for the ambulances in Bristol, just by Castle Park, was sold off by John Savage, who's the chair of Business West, who are supposedly partners with the council, sold off to property developers because of the prime land that it's on in the city centre. It was a purpose-built ambulance headquarters where the ambulances were serviced and all the crews were based. And it was in a perfect position to be able to fly ambulances out around the city. Mm. Now, the industrial estate where the ambulances are now is right next to the ring road, which often gets very congested. So I would say to John Savage, you and your Business West people who like to infiltrate government and take public land, sell it off to your mates, because your mates can make an absolute fortune and you maybe get a backhander. I mean, this is, I think, one of the things at the root of this. But actually, Martin, it's the actual funding for the NHS, which is a whole other contributing factor as to how this wonderful organisation set up after World War II. As you yourself have pointed out, you know, when you're in the middle of a war, you stop thinking about who it is that's going to help save someone's life, and you just make sure that the state is providing this. It's a much wider crisis. We're seeing the private health companies booming as a result.
Yeah, I'm actually in Leinster here, and my father actually fell over last week and broke his hip. And there was 10 hours before the ambulance arrived. Now, when they arrived, they were extremely professional, but that was a 10-hour wait, and that's not unusual. And, of course, in rural areas, that's the sort of wait you can expect, and that's one of the reasons why the Tories lost the North Shropshire seat not far from here, which was one of their, you know, core seats, because these are the kind of issues that were coming up, not least, of course, Owen Paterson basically being on the take, which also made quite a bit of a difference. One of the things that's blocking, that they talk about unblocking the health service, is there is no proper provision for social care after people are released from hospital. And that, of course, what Boris Johnson did is he said he's going to raise national insurance contributions in order to pay for that. But of course, it never got those national insurance contributions have now been rescinded. Now, in other words, hard choices lie ahead. But of course, if we hadn't bailed the banks out, if we hadn't gone to war in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, if we had a proper tax system, because in 1979, the top rate of tax in this country was 83%, and in the 1950s, it was 95%, then we wouldn't be in the crisis that we're in. Now, as we go into the crisis coming up, we're going to have to look at national priorities and what we really want to spend our money on. And that includes, for example, taxing capital gains. Capital gains are not properly taxed. Your income is taxed, but capital gains aren't taxed. The council tax is totally regressive. poorer people pay more proportionately ultimately than wealthier people. And that this is the result of decades of rigging the system in favour of those who already have, the haves, have nots.
Yeah, and in fact, Martin, what you're saying there feeds quite nicely into our final clip from Prime Minister's Questions. And I think Richard Burgeon, who actually was, I think it was back in May this year, we had quite an extended interview with him on the show. A very interesting character. Met up with him at Burford in Oxfordshire for Levellers Day, which is this celebration, well, I don't know about celebration, commemoration of the Cromwell's murder of two, execution of two Leveller soldiers who refused to go and fight in Ireland. But Richard was down there giving his speech, and he gave us a little exclusive interview at the time. But anyway, here's Richard Burgeon, I think, doing a very good job for the Labour Party on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions.
Richard Burgeon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I welcome the Prime Minister to his place. A nurse would have to work over 20,000 years in order to match the vast wealth of this Prime Minister. The Prime Minister knows only too well that the super rich could easily afford to pay more in taxes. So rather than announce a new wave of cuts and austerity, wouldn't it be fairer for the Prime Minister to introduce wealth taxes on the very richest in our society?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we will always support our hard-working nurses, and that's why, as Chancellor, we reintroduced the nurses' bursary and provided more training and introduced, actually, very strong pay increases. But as I committed to previously, as we approach the difficult decisions that confront us, we will do so in a way that is fair and is compassionate, because those are our values and that's what we will deliver.
Really? Well, I wonder about that. Farouk, what do you make of this idea? I mean, he's basically saying, no, I'm not going to tax myself and my mates. So tough.
Yeah, and he won't. I mean, that's a Tory philosophy, isn't it? That's their ideology. The rich just get richer, and the poor just get poorer. There's no two ways about it. And in terms of the NHS, if you were genuine about the NHS, you wouldn't have appointed, was it Jeremy Hunt when he became the National Health Minister? Who wrote a book on how to privatise the NHS. So, I mean, it's this is what gets my gut about the Tories completely. You know, the people trust them with the economy. Okay, I understand that. But the overall, the economy that they talk about, the trickle-down economy, doesn't work. I mean, that's been, you know, proven, and yet still Liz Truss tried to do that trickle-down economy works. This guy comes in a little bit more intelligent than Liz Truss. He's got a lot more capable background. But the ideology is still the same. It's for my mates. They've all gone to the same schools. They've all gone to the same colleges, universities. They're mates. They've known each other from school days. And it's just a bunch of mates running the top of the Tory party and now the country and the rest of us.
It's Bristol too. I mean, we had that report on Bristol 24/7 saying most council employees say don't trust the leadership of Bristol City Council. So there's a similar sort of thing going on there. Anyway, Martin, what's your response?
Well, I mean, the Tories in public talk about the NHS and how they cherish it, but we saw in Britannia Unchanged that Kwesi Kwarteng and Liz Truss both wrote in it, and Jeremy Hunt has been pushing for the privatisation of the healthcare service for a long time. And of course, what's happened now with the backlogs that we've got is that those who have got some resources are going private to get things done. And once they've done that, you've then got a substantial section of the population who suddenly think, well, I don't want to pay taxes for other people's healthcare. And of course, this is a
20,000 years is a long time to have to work to become, you know, in the same sort of position as Rishi Sunak. And I do wonder if, you know, the government would be done a lot better if they just kind of pick people at random, you know, like the National Lottery or something, to take over these jobs, or even get a tramp from London in those jobs, because it does seem as if the entire country is not democratic. It's not representing what people want. It's representing what the super rich want. And one of the big, I mean, you mentioned this whole business of of social care. You're quite right, Martin. You know, this is one of the major problems with the National Health Service, is simply not being addressed by these people at all, because they rather rub their hands watching the horrors going on with people being left for, you know, sometimes days on trolleys, not being treated in hospitals, groaning, because they know that this is, sends a very clear message to people that, you know, forget the NHS, you've got to go private. Anyway, look, another big side of all of this is inflation. And I noticed it was just about a week or a bit over a week ago, just as I was leaving, and it was Jamie Jenkins was on Talk Radio chatting about this. He's the former, I think, health statistician at the National Office for Statistics on Talk Radio, talking about the actual causes of inflation. And before we hear from him, I'd like to hear from both of you two, if you don't mind, just what you think is behind inflation. Then we'll hear from Jamie. So you first, Farouk. What do you? I mean, because it seems. You know, it's a major problem. As soon as, you know, food prices start going up and up and up, transport prices, etc., people just cannot. It's almost like it's undermining everything that you've planned for years. And I remember I had a chat to an old BBC friend of mine from Wiltshire a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying, well, it's the first time I've ever felt that I just cannot plan for the future because everything's being undermined. So what's behind this inflation, do you think, Farouk?
Well, to be fair, I mean, I know the traditional thing is that there's too much money in the economy. Well, wherever that money is, it's certainly not in the hands of the vast majority of people working a 9-to-5. If you have a look at, you know, let's look at China. The prices have gone through the roof because there's a lack of storage containers to transport. So during COVID, all their storage containers got stuck in countries overseas. They couldn't get them back. And then once they got them back, people sold them off. And what you realize is that these companies that do storage started going bust. They got bought out by other companies. And now, where you had maybe 30, 40 transport companies around the world, now you've got maybe, was it 4 or 5, something like that. And they realize that actually they can charge much higher prices for those storage containers. If you go back to that, so if this, the cost of transporting our daily needs, the biscuits on our tables, the food on our breakfast, etc., if the cost of transporting all of that has gone through the roof because 3 or 4 companies now control, literally monopolize the transport industry with a shortage of containers, how come nobody's looking at that? Because that seems to me obvious that that is causing a major part of the inflation, not to mention the banks just keep printing money that doesn't exist.
Yeah. Martin?
Well, as Farouk says, that, you know, there's one school of thought that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. It clearly isn't. You get what you might call inflation caused by bottlenecks in production, and that requires that you have to take different kinds of measures in order to deal with that sort of inflation than you would an inflation caused by excess money. But of course, what's happened since the low inflation era, when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2000 or around then, is that we've had massive asset price inflation. House prices rising, and that's regarded as good because, of course, it means wealthy people get wealthier. But it is, in fact, inflation, and all of those costs are then passed on in terms of ordinary people's consumption because the asset prices feed into the real prices. What's happened now with partly to do with the sanctions on Russia is that we've got this inflation returning to the same levels as the 1970s. And of course, what they're now going to do and what the United States is doing is raising interest rates to bring that down, which of course is going to bankrupt many developing countries like Pakistan. And of course, it's a very hostile policy to the developing countries. And, the problem with inflation is that in order to contain it, you then have to put people out of work if you're going to pursue that kind of policy.
I mean, it seems very obvious to me that the main cause of it, I mean, you know, okay, so everyone's got their own view, but the main cause of it is the massive inflation of energy prices, because these have a knock-on effect, enormous knock-on effect on everything, every kind of service, everything you buy in the shops, whatever goods and services are all going up, 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 because everyone's having to pay more for fuel, pay more to heat, the farmers having to pay more for fertilizer. Energy prices are really kind of the baseline, I think, which, is driving so much of this. And that really started, I mean, the first big increase we saw was, was it roughly this time last year with the fuel tankers. The tankers, apparently Shell and BP couldn't afford to pay their tanker drivers, which I don't believe a word of. But they were starving the fuel stations, and this is what they do in third world countries, in order to put the prices up. So I think that this is energy company driven, and as we've seen, they've got their reward through this massive bailout of that Truss announced, and that which is being carried on at least for a year or so by Rishi Sunak. But anyway, look, let's have a listen to see what Jamie Jenkins makes of what is really behind inflation, because I think it so undermines everybody who's at a middle low income, and of course we're getting to the point now where they're talking about not bringing up benefit rates in line with inflation, which means of course that the poorest in society are simply not going to be able to feed their kids anymore. So let's have a listen to Jamie.
You talk about a party or a political party, that's normally a group of people coming together, they share common beliefs, but you've got a political party, as you talked about, the Tories now at the moment, where they had their mini budget a few weeks ago. They then changed the Chancellor and kind of gone completely, not just a U-turn, complete kind of the other way. And this is the same party, you know. So if you vote for the Tory party at the moment, nobody knows where you're voting for. And you talk, so inflation's 10.1%, Mike. Now, the key drivers of that is still all of these global factors. So it's the energy costs. That would be getting worse inflation over the coming months if the government hadn't stepped in to kind of put that limit in terms of what the energy rates are going to be going up. But obviously we've got food going up, transport going up, anything that is made with energy is affected, which is most of the things in the economy, Mike. And what's adding that additional woe now? So the IMF come out, they were very critical of the mini budget, the Kwasi Kwarteng came out with, and they were calling on making some U-turns, and they said that the U-turns that Jeremy Hunt have come up with is a good move to control inflation. Well, it's not, Mike. It's because, cutting the taxes or what the government was planning on doing is not going to fix the energy crisis abroad. It's not going to fix kind of the food costs and things. The thing that's we've got to keep an eye on, Mike, is the USA at the moment, because you can't divorce what happens with the US and what happens in the UK, because interest rates are kind of driven globally as well. And what we've seen is the US Fed, we've got the biggest gap in interest rates now between them and the UK. They pushed them up quite a bit last month. We went up a little bit as well. And what happens is, Mike, if you don't put the UK interest rates up in line with where they are going in the US, then what happens is more and more people are buying the dollar, which makes the dollar stronger. So all the energy and the oil that we import becomes more expensive. Yeah. So I think you've been talking about petrol prices are starting to go back up now. So if the US push interest rates up further, we are going to have to follow. I don't think this is the right approach, Mike, to tackle this global inflation, but this is where we are.
Mm. And so it's being led, we're being led around by the nose in a way by the US Federal Reserve, aren't we?
Indeed, and so they'll put interest rates up again, Mike. We will have to think the Bank of England governor was saying that interest rates will have to go up again. They will have to go up because we've got this biggest gap we've seen for a while now between us and the US. The US go up again, we will go up. So the Labour Party, you'll get them on your show, Mike, and they'll say that the interest rate rises are all down to Liz Truss mini budget. That is a small part of it. We did see the markets get spooked a little bit about it. But a big chunk of this is the global markets and the US putting up interest rates. So the Labour Party can't blame all of this on Liz Truss. It's a fraction, but not the biggest part of it.
I mean, I hadn't listened to the whole of that clip before. You probably won't believe me, but I think he's right. But I mean, what he's saying there, Martin, is that the solutions that are being proffered are not going to work, and also the analysis of why we've got this inflation is also completely wrong.
Well, we're stuck in this ideological world where the only way to control inflation is through increasing interest rates and taking demand out of the economy. Now, in actual fact, in the past, we had things like prices and incomes policy, very successfully pursued in Scandinavia, whereby you try and control wage inflation through negotiation with trade unions. But we trashed that years ago in this country. So there's only one club in the golf trolley, and that is raising interest rates, which of course basically then crashes the economy and doesn't solve the problem, because when the economy starts to grow again after you've trashed it, it's that much smaller, which is why we've had successive waves of deindustrialization in Britain. And of course the US is now cracking the whip internationally by raising interest rates. It sucks lots of money out of Europe, for example, and into the US stock market. And they are basically looting Western Europe as they've looted the rest of the world for decades.
Well, that's right. They're also possibly plunging it into war. So anyway, Farouk, what do you make of Jamie's analysis there? Because I think we've got to actually understand what's going on. There seem to be very few people who've really understood why prices are going up as they are. And it does seem to me deliberate.
And it does, yeah. As I said, he's spot on, and I'm sure there's many other causes as well. And it's not the traditional, you know, too much money in the economy. As I said, just one example is those transport industry, transporting oil, our energy, all of that around the world. Those transporters are getting less and less. The containers are getting less and less. They're charging a lot more per unit. And it's gone something like, I think it was 1,500. To transport from here to Pakistan, and it's now 6,500 to transport to Pakistan. Same kind of issues, is that there are just not enough containers around. And that, who's benefiting that, is a small clique of people who own these transport companies, who have influence over the countries that they've all variously reside in, and in push politics for their mates who are in politics, people like Rishi Sunak, who bring in favorable policies to keep that kind of monopoly going. It's a vicious circle where the rich just keep getting richer, the poor keep getting poorer. And that applies globally as well. The rich countries are just getting richer and richer, and the poorer ones are getting poorer and poorer.
Well, it certainly, I mean, not necessarily in Russia. If you look at the food prices in Russia, they've been going down at the same sort of rate the food prices here have been going up. And I was very impressed to see The Sun, Rupert Murdoch's Sun, a few weeks ago, putting a chart, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of exactly how cheap potatoes are now in Russia. You know, anyway, before we go to the break, and I hope you'll be able to stay with us, obviously, you know, we'd be lovely to talk to you about Pakistan after the break. We're going to have a 10-minute break in a minute, but for some music. And I just wanted to point out this interesting bit of news from the New York Supreme Court, which has reinstated all employees fired for being unvaccinated and ordered, which is the crucial bit, ordered back pay. So what do you make of that, Farouk? Maybe you first, because this is interesting, isn't it? A lot of people, in fact, we had interviewees from the NHS here in the UK in April this year who were being told, you've got to get a vaccination, otherwise we're going to sack you. Mm. Well, just like a day before the deadline, the NHS officials changed their mind. They said, oh, actually, no, you know, you don't have to get a vaccine. You can keep your jobs. In the States, a lot of people were actually fired. In fact, many care home workers here in the UK were fired. But in America now, the courts have ruled that this was unlawful to dismiss them, and that the employers that did have got to pay them all back pay, which is quite a big decision.
It is, and it's one that I think we should welcome generally. And I think, you know, the initial reactions to COVID, I think, were over the top. You could say understandably so, because people didn't understand what was going on, what was taking place, etc. Our own reactions, I mean, when you think back on it, you know, locking ourselves in. I mean, and I know it was a little bit more, the COVID disease issue was a little bit more serious than it is now. It's gone. The fatality of the COVID version now is a lot less than it was initially. People have had the vaccines. It seems to have, even in its strength, has gone down itself. So there's swings and roundabouts. But I certainly think firing people for not taking vaccines was a bit over the top. And it's welcome that these people are getting their jobs back and getting back pay.
Martin, interesting decision, isn't it, over in the States? Especially, you don't often hear about decisions in this country about people being, employers being told you've got to take back that employee, you sack them unlawfully, and particularly you've got to pay them for the last year that after you sack them up till now.
Well, I didn't know that was the decision you just told me. What interests me, Tony, is you're in New Zealand and you're not vaccinated. How did you get into New Zealand?
Well, I can't possibly tell you. It's a secret.
Were you vaccinated to go to New Zealand, Tony?
Well, that's my private personal information. No, of course I wasn't vaccinated. You don't need to be vaccinated to come here anymore. Right. I mean, okay. You know, it's a bit like the NHS. You know, they put up all these things saying people get very afraid. And it's the nudge unit. It's what we were talking about, coercion. Earlier on, if you remember, you know, we had a little item all about how people have been being coerced, and of course they were coerced. In fact, we talked earlier on about, what was it called? The Biderman's chart of coercion, which is used to assess domestic abuse cases. Actually, the coercion has been being used by things like the nudge units to get people to do things which are actually against their own medical or their own personal health potentially. So no, you know, they dropped all this stuff. So I mean, I was wondering, you know, how long it was going to take before being able to come back. And you don't need any kind of vaccine certificate to come here anymore. Nothing like that. No. Anyway,
don't forget that the Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare units, they're openly saying, as the Iranian Revolutionary Guard have been saying, is that COVID-19 was a bioweapon.
Well, we're openly saying
the Chinese are interpreting it as an attack on their country, which is why they
locked down. I'm openly saying it, and you're openly saying it, and lots of people who have switched on are openly saying that the Chinese and the Yanks and the Pentagon colluded in Wuhan.
No, they didn't collude. They are at war, Tony. This is a warfare attack. This is what Jeremy Sachs is saying.
Hang on. Look, Martin, you just keep interrupting. Let me finish what I'm saying, then you can have your say, yeah? Is that they colluded together there to a certain extent, of course, at the highest levels. The Chinese and the Americans, through the Hunter Biden and the rest of them, are colluding in many ways. And so that's, I mean, we're not...
Revolutionary Guard head, Salami, is on the record as saying that he thinks it's a biological warfare attack by the Americans on Iran.
The thing with the COVID virus is it was pitched at a certain level, it wasn't like anthrax or something. It wasn't killing so many people.
It's designed to wreck your economy. But of course, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
And actually, it was the response that wrecked the economy because, as we now know.
In China, the economy has actually been much stronger than it was in this country.
There were all sorts of treatments which were available, very cheap, out of patent treatments, which were used in some countries like India, but certainly weren't used in the West. Anyway. I don't know if you want to weigh in on this one, Farouk, anything to say about COVID?
I can give you a little bit of perspective. I mean, we're talking about how bad it was. I mean, in Pakistan, there was no lockdowns, apart from isolated ones where they thought it might get out of control. And they did not see mass casualties. They did not see mass deaths. And that is something even the UN World Health Organization still can't get their head around. And they're going around investigating that maybe their numbers weren't correct, etc. But there was no, they've checked with, you know, cemeteries and villages, and there were no mass burials. There were no increase in deaths. And the rollout of the vaccine was late as well, because obviously everyone was trying to get the vaccine and Pakistan was back of the queue because it's a poorer country. And they did not lock down because Imran Khan decided that he couldn't afford to lock down because his daily workers would just starve to death. They don't have the resources to support them like the Western countries do. And there were no mass deaths.
Lovely cue in, because we're going to have some music now, from beginning with Quasar, and then we'll be picking up on what's been going on in Pakistan over the last week after the break.
Del quinto centenario.
Straight in at number three on the DJ's choice, and most of the tracks in the charts are upbeat house records, and it's no real surprise because, as we know, Amsterdam is house nation of the world. We'll be right back.
someone who forgot to reset it.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
hardcore, I think, is the technical term. And that, well, it's a, I think, great selection, especially here on Saturday morning. Early Saturday morning, time for a rave in New Zealand. No, I think it's probably more appropriate for a Friday night in Bristol. I mean, it's not obviously just the National Health Service that has been smashed to bits. It's also the rave scene and other things to do with the British music industry that have been smashed to bits. So that was beginning with Quasar, Fast Forward into the Future from Holland from 1991. X-Sight, that's X-SIGHT. The Light, that's a British tune from 1992. And finally, there's Zero B, who is still going strong. They've got their own kind of Facebook thing, and they're still gigging. A couple of lads from up north, and that's a British tune from 1991. So that is our musical break for today. A bit of a flashback to the early 90s rave scene. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, on the new talkradio.co.uk, sorry, .org.uk stream, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, also at radioqUK.com live in Camberley, Surrey. The app you can get on the app, the Apple App Store, and not necessarily Google as well. So anyway, we're joined by Farouk Siddiq, who's from the Bristol Pakistan Association, and also Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And I asked you in, Farouk, to talk about Pakistan, particularly because I'm just appalled by the obvious murder, assassination, really, of this. It's unbelievable, really, when you look at these things, to see how little coverage something like this gets. It's a Pakistani journalist, Arshad Sharif, who was quite a pro Imran Khan journalist. I mean, obviously, journalists like to say they're unbiased, but none of them are. And he's been accidentally, in big inverted commas, killed by police over in Kenya. He had to flee Pakistan. He was in the Middle East for a while, and his visitor visa ran out. So he decided to go to Kenya, where he was promptly gunned down by the police. So can you just give us a little bit of a background to this case? Because what it's showing to me is that the supporters of Imran Khan, who's the elected president of Pakistan, are actually, anyone that supports him is now being targeted by this government. Now, you know, it'd be interesting to know a little bit about the government too, and these figures, Sharif and Zardari, who are now running the show there.
Prime Minister Sharif and his cohort is Zardari. So you had Benazir's party. Do you remember Benazir Bhutto? So hers was a Pakistan People's Party. She was killed. And the party was taken over by her husband, who was known as Mr. 10% because he was a gangster, one of these mafia-type individuals who married into the Bhutto clan. And the Sharifs, well, they were actually manufactured from another political party by the Pakistani army to try and bring that party to heel. And so you have now 13, I believe, political parties from across the Pakistani political spectrum. Only Imran Khan's PTI party now stands outside of the current coalition of the government at the moment. Now, what's happened here is, since Imran Khan has decided that he's not going to go quietly into the night, as was the script handed to him, so anyone that now stands or questions either the government, which was brought in by the Pakistani army in response to a letter by Donald Liu, the Undersecretary of State for the United States, who said that because Imran Khan went to visit Russia, Moscow, on the day that Russia attacked Ukraine, instead of leaving, Imran Khan stayed and tried to complete a deal to buy oil and corn, I think it was, wheat, for his population. He believed, and his view is, that regardless of what happens in Western countries, his priority is the Pakistani population who elected him, and his job was to try and bring them, keep prices under control, which he was doing, actually managing quite well up until March 22 when he was ousted. Now, as soon as he made that visit and decided he was going to continue to forge relations with Russia, the American Undersecretary of State started meeting the opposition, brought them together. These are vehemently opposed political parties who despise each other, have called each other thieves and corrupt and to the kingdom come, basically. They all suddenly came together after Donald Liu, Undersecretary of State, told the Pakistani ambassador to the United States that if you remove Imran Khan through a no-confidence motion, all will be forgiven, and you can come back to power. Now, this is the Americans telling the Pakistanis who should run their country. And promptly, the next day, Imran Khan's government was subject to a no-confidence motion, and that no-confidence motion, Imran Khan lost only because, I think it was 21 members of his own party sold out, literally sold out, for it was $200,000 each to leave Imran Khan's government. And that allowed the no-confidence motion to pass. Imran Khan was ousted. Now, as I said, instead of going quietly into the night, Imran Khan then decided to fight back. And he believed he was the subject of a conspiracy, an international conspiracy, concocted by the United States to remove him from power because for a number of reasons. Number one, his calls to make good relations with Russia, putting Pakistan first. And secondly, his denial for the Americans to give them military bases and overflight rights across Pakistani airspace to ban drone attacks by the United States on Pakistani soil. And he actually told the army, he said to the Americans quite openly that I've told my army that if an American drone flies over Pakistan, shoot it down. So that was the beginning of the end of Imran Khan's tenure in power.
Well, and I mean, that the background to the drones, if I can just interrupt for a yeah. It was horrific, wasn't it? There were things like wedding parties, yeah. funerals, the double tap drone strike where yeah. you destroy an event like that with a drone, and then as the rescuers appear over maybe an hour or so later, you then hit those yeah. people with another drone. I mean, it's quite understandable that any kind of sovereign country might wish to stop the Americans behaving like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. During Imran Khan's the government that was in charge before, there were 200 drone attacks during the Nawaz Sharif government. During Imran Khan's government, not a single drone attack took place during his power. As soon as he was removed, within 2 weeks, we had the first drone attack. So that just proved the point about Imran Khan and the reason that they wanted to remove him from power. Now, Imran Khan, they expected, would, because they accused him of all kinds of stuff, they've thrown all kinds of mud at Imran Khan. Nothing has stuck because his motto has been consistent throughout. He says, have another election. He says he cannot accept the fact that he was removed by non-Pakistanis. He says the only people that can decide who governs Pakistan is Pakistanis. And for that simple he's been fighting. That's all he wants. All he wants is elections. And he says
what's his latest stance? Because I understand that he's saying that he wants his supporters to just sort of back off from having demonstrations over the last week or so.
Right. So what happened last time, I think it was May 25th, there was a big march, and they were attacked by the interior minister with tear gas, baton charges, and all of that, and quite a few people were injured. And the people were fired up to the point that they were going to do basically what happened in Sri Lanka. And Imran Khan didn't want loss of life, so he called off that. He completely pulled back, and he says, let's call it a day. His own supporters turned against him for that because the people were ready. They stayed. The people stayed on those streets for a couple of weeks before eventually leaving. Now what's happened is since that time, anyone who has been vocal in their support of what we consider in their terminology as an independent, of free, what's it called? He's calling Hakiki Azadi, which means true freedom march. So that's what he's calling it for. And he says, when he says true freedom, he's saying true freedom since 1947, when we became free, independent from the British Raj. That was our freedom from them, but then we became slaves to the corruption.
So, well, I think there's lots of ex-British colonial places that would say the same. You
exactly.
know, in Africa, for example, with the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, you know, the idea is that, you know, you let the British colonial powers and the international powers allowed certain leaders to emerge of these independent, newly independent countries with a kind of great ideals for the future, and then those that became successful, couldn't be bribed, etc., were simply assassinated.
And that's exactly what's been going on. And what you've found since March 25th is you've had this build-up on both sides. So Imran Khan is saying he wants an election because, as far as he's concerned, only the people of Pakistan should vote and decide who runs Pakistan. And on the other side, you've got the army who are supporting the what they call the Pakistan Democratic Movement, I believe they're called, this coalition of the corrupt, basically. Now, their cabinet, the current government cabinet, 60% of the current cabinet is on bail for charges ranging from corruption to murder. The current interior minister has cases, 13 cases registered against him of him killing people, literally murdering people. He's now the interior minister who's basically been given free hand to deal with Imran Khan and his people and his supporters. Now what's happened over the last few months is that anyone that is seen to be supporting Imran Khan in any way, shape or form, and when I say supporting Imran, it means even being slightly critical of the government or the army, is suddenly, and I can't remember this in my lifetime, but apparently it's been happening, is suddenly they're getting arrested, they're being tortured, they're being held naked, stripped naked, tortured, and then the euphemism is their software has been updated, and then they release them, yeah, because the courts order their release because there was no reason to arrest them in the first place. So once it gets to the courts, they get released. But the thing is that their software has been updated. Now, the reason for stripping them naked, beating them in front of their children, arresting them in their homes. Now, this thing we think, oh, it's nothing, arresting people in their homes, when the police jumps over people's personal home walls, the boundary walls of their homes. In Pakistan, that's considered a massive deal, that this is your personal home. The state has no right to cross those boundaries. Now, under the current government in the last couple of months, that's been happening almost on a weekly, fortnightly basis, that police have gone over people's home boundaries to arrest them, sometimes with warrants, sometimes without warrants, only to be released later without charge.
What do you mean? I've got to ask you about what you mean by this updating their software. Is the idea that people have kind of been through a very, very strict and very quick re-education?
Exactly. Exactly. So basically, TikTokers, I mean, this is the banality of it. This is how pathetic this army has become, or the leaders of the Pakistani army are, that any criticism of the current Chief of Army Staff, General Bajwa, or the current ISI chief, any criticism that they see is a personal attack on them. So they're being called traitors, they're being called all kinds of corrupt, etc., because they all own property abroad, etc. So,
it sounds to me as if you could be, just stating a fact about one of these members of the cabinet, and that would be taken. I mean, it's also rather similar to the reverence which the Chinese legal system affords to, well, I call him the Pope, you know, President Xi. You're not allowed to criticize. And this authoritarianism is absolutely horrific, really, in a country like Pakistan.
It absolutely is. And what's shocking is that they're supposed to be a democracy. And that's what the people leading this charge now are. Amazingly, they're the students, they're the young people, they are educating, they're standing up and saying, enough is enough. What's going on here? We're supposed to be, you keep talking about this being a democracy. the courts still seem to be, many of those judges are bought out. When the push comes to shove, they tend to take the right course of action. So at the moment, that's the only hope, the last line. But that hasn't stopped all these people. When I say software being updated, it means if you carry on doing what you're doing, next time you're just going to disappear for good. So they suddenly back off, or supposed to back off. And some have, but others have come out even more vociferous against the army. Now, recently, it's come from, 15, 16-year-old TikTokers who've got influential following. They're being just picked up, beaten up for no reason.
I'm also reminded of the Pinochet regime in Chile. This was very similar. It's a fascistic attitude. But could you just talk about this journalist Arshad Sharif? I've been reading about this. I mean, he apparently was quite a popular journalist, TV journalist in Pakistan. And then had to leave Pakistan, and he's just this week been assassinated in Kenya by the police there.
Yeah, so he worked for ARY, which is one of the top news channels. So it's like CNN in Pakistan. And he had his own shows. He was an anchor as well as an investigative reporter. And I've watched some of his reports, and whatever he says, he does the research and he brings up all the evidence in front of you. So whatever he says is based on fact. He was started to be threatened because he started to ask the wrong questions, if you see what I mean, from the Pakistani government and from the chief of army staff. Nobody challenged the army up to this point. In a major way, in such an open way that journalists started to do after Imran Khan's ouster. And the army's response, and some people say it's the government doing it, some people say it's the army doing it, but it's quite obvious it's the all-powerful armies behind everything. The army's response has been to try and shut down any dissent at all. And they've done it in a really clumsy, retarded fashion. I mean, it's so pathetic the way they've done it. And all it's done is to actually further enrage the general population on top of the economic crash. So this gentleman, continued to do his reports despite being threatened, and then he would share those threats on his TV channel that I've been threatened by this, I've been getting these phone calls, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually ARY was barred from broadcast, just taken off the air, just like that, with no reason, no warning. It was just gone off the air. Now, the equivalent of Ofcom in Pakistan is PEMRA. When the journalists asked them why ARY has been taken off air, they said, "We don't know." So the question then is, who took ARY off air? Now, ARY stayed off air, and you can imagine when a channel goes off, they had 20,000 employees. When a channel goes off air, they're risking the livelihoods of 20,000 of their employees. And eventually, after, I think it's about 3 or 4 weeks, ARY was allowed back on air only after Arshad Sharif and one other journalist had been removed from their schedules, all of a sudden. No warning, no nothing. So this journalist is now out in the open. He doesn't have ARY support. And all the other channels that wanted to take him, because everyone was running after him, say, "Well, we'll take you." Another channel tried to take him on. They were taken off air. Okay. Another journalist called Imran Riaz Khan was arrested, exactly like Arshad Rashif. He was arrested. He was tortured. He was beaten for no reason. And then he was released after it all went to court, even though, I'll cut a long story short. So all this started happening. Another journalist, Jamil Farouki, he was picked up at the airport. Again, no reason, but except the fact that they worked for these channels and their narrative was tended to be seen as anti-government and not so pro, government, not so pro, army. Jamil Farouki never even said anything seriously. He was one of these, he did his reports in a sarcastic, comedic way. So he would do it not directly, but indirectly in a very satirical fashion. He was taken, beaten up, and his so-called software was updated. When he came back on air, totally different. When ARY came back on air, they then refused to cover Imran Khan's broadcast. So his speeches, his rallies, didn't cover them to keep whoever allowed them back on air, to keep them happy. The same then happened with another news channel, Ball, whose ratings went through the roof after clearly ARY's narrative had changed. Everyone started watching Ball Channel, and the same thing happened with them. They are suddenly taken off air. They were suddenly starting to show Imran Khan speeches. Their ratings went through the roof. They're suddenly taken off air. Now, Ball has decided to stick their ground. So they're saying, fine, you want to take us off air? They did a really good streaming service, internet, and carried on running their show. They couldn't control Ball. And Ball decided that it was going to be even more vociferous in what it was trying to do. This has carried on. Now, Urshad Sharif, after he got removed from ARY, he was hounded. He was threatened. People outside, and when I say threatened, I'm talking about people turning up at his door, people hanging around outside his door with guns, etc., etc., etc. His family being threatened. Another journalist whose father got removed from his job. They shut down his business. I mean, these kinds of harassments to journalists were now becoming commonplace. Urshad Sharif was then threatened that he was going to be picked up as well. He decided he was going to leave the country. He left the country and went to Dubai. The same night he left for the country, ARY's vice president, I believe, the same thing happened to him. Police jumped over his home, personal home, harassed his family, arrested him, took him in, tortured him, beat him, and we still don't know what's happened to the guy, what happened to him, but he's gone completely silent. ARY's Urshad Sharif, he went to Dubai. His visa was running out. He still had 10 days left for his visa in Dubai. And apparently there are rumors that somebody from the Pakistani army contacted the family in the ruling family in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and asked them to either bring Sharif back to Pakistan or send him on, move him on. Whatever the truth, and that's still being investigated, Sharif leaves Dubai because he's still under threat in Pakistan, and he goes to Kenya. In Kenya, he's then, I think 3 or 4 days later, he is comes across, and this is the story of the Kenyans now. So according to Kenyan media, Kenyan news reports, the initial report was a child had been kidnapped, a roadblock had been set up, Urshad Sharif's car matched the child, kidnapped car, and he drove past, didn't stop. We shot at the car, and it was killed by accident. Then the reports came that actually it was a stolen car they were looking for, because the media started saying, well, hold on, why did you shoot at a car that may have contained a kidnapped child? Then the story changed to...
So they're making it up as they're going along, basically.
Literally. I mean, if you look, go back and have a look at Kenyan media, they change their story. The police changes their story 4 times in 3 days. So then their story came out that it was a stolen car they were looking for, and then the media started asking. Kenyan media, forget the world media, Kenyan media said, what was the car that was being stolen? First it was, we don't know, then it was a Mercedes-Benz, and then it was a Mercedes-Benz van. Now, the car that Imran Khan, Urshad Sharif was killed in was a Land Cruiser V8. A Mercedes-Benz van and a Land Cruiser V8 is a massive difference. Two completely different number plates as well.
So, I mean, basically, this was just a hit. You know, it was an assassination.
It was an absolute hit. Yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded a bit when talking about this of... I remember when he was releasing the information about the gain-of-function research, Peter Daszak, at the Wuhan Lab and EcoHealth Alliance on his Tucker Carlson program. He actually did a program himself where he said, well, I'm getting these messages from the National Security Agency, you know, threatening me, you know. Yeah. So that's Tucker Carlson on Fox News.
Yeah.
We've also had here in Bristol, Alex Seabrook, who's one of the local democracy reporters, basically being banned by the Mayor Marvin Rees, the Labour Mayor, from press conferences because he asked a rather awkward question about does it really make sense for the mayor to be flying 7,000, 8,000 miles in order to do a talk which he could do about climate change on Zoom.
And then
for asking a cheeky question, well, it's not a cheeky question, it's a very good question.
It's a legitimate question, absolutely.
He's banned. Now, it's good to see in Bristol, you know, the reaction being that the other journalists in the city from BBC, ITV, Bristol Post, Bristol 24/7, etc., all boycotted those press conferences because Marvin Rees tried to pull this little trick with picking off journalists who asked him awkward questions. So, you know, it's quite a contrast, luckily, between Bristol and Pakistan. But you're painting a picture of behaviour of the Pakistani authorities, particularly the army, Farooq, literally of a mafia running the country, a fascist mafia.
And that's and you're not far off in that assessment. I mean, that's what is absolutely enraging the Pakistani public. And as I say, it's the young people that are leading this. But having said, young people are leading this. People attending Imran Khan's rallies are families. So the elders are there, the women are there, little children are there, and obviously the youth contingent is there. But in terms of what they're doing to the Pakistani media, is again, it is. Honestly, it is nothing short of fascism. I mean, the power has got to their head, and they think they can do and say what they want. Now,
it sounds to me as if the Pakistani authorities are spending much more time trying to destroy their opposition than they are actually running and managing the country. Martin Summers, what do you make of what's going on over there? I mean, I'm comparing these disappearances, the threats and things to Pinochet, etc. Is that over the top?
No, obviously not. I mean, there hasn't been continuous democracy in Pakistan since independence, and the army have openly ruled the country at various stages. Mm. And they're definitely the power behind the throne, and they work very closely with the United States. Yep. So, I mean, this is quite common in the developing world, where comprador elites are bought by the Western powers. And they're not really they're ruling in their own interests, obviously, but also in the interests of foreign powers like the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting that the youngsters, because it's their future that these people are destroying, and there's a wrestle for the future of Pakistan, Farooq, isn't there?
And that's exactly how Imran Khan's defined it. I mean, he started today because they buried Arshad Sharif yesterday in what I can only describe as probably the largest funeral that has ever taken place in Pakistan and Islamabad, I mean, in the history of Pakistan. I mean, it was massive. You just have to look at the video of that. And this is for a journalist, for an investigative journalist, who all he did was speak the truth. And that's what people are saying. And even at his funeral, the chants from the public were, freedom we'll take. Your dad will give us freedom. We'll snatch our freedom. Yeah, saying that was basically directed at the army, right? Now, today, Imran Khan has decided against his will. He didn't want to do it. But because of the killing of Arshad Sharif, he's now been left no choice, he feels. It's now or never. So he's now decided he's going to go for what he's calling the Long March. So this is, he starts in Lahore, is going to go through major Pakistani cities, literally at walking pace. And by next week, he's going to end up in Islamabad. And effectively, by the number of people that he's expecting, is lay siege to the capital of the country, including the headquarters of the Pakistani army and the seat of power in Pakistan. And he's going to lay siege to that. It's going to be inevitable. Whether he says, he denies he's going to lay siege, he says he's doing a peaceful demonstration protest about what's happening in the country. But effectively, because of the numbers of people that will walk with him, it will effectively be a siege. There's no way around it. Now, the interior ministry, the murderer that is the home minister at the moment, he's already laid out the gauntlet. And he says, if you come, I've bought even more modern tear gas. I've got drones, he said. You know, with glee, he says, I've got drones, and I'll be firing drones at you and your people as soon as you arrive. So he's preparing for a war. Now, the Pakistani army yesterday, in desperation, for the first time ever, the head of the ISI, the Pakistani Secret Service, alongside the Chief of Army Staff's representative, did a press conference. The ISA has never done a press conference in its history. This was the first time they've done a press conference. And they looked scared. They looked incompetent, and they looked disheveled. And it was because of what Imran Khan has decided, that he's not backing down. Everything they do to try and bring him down, there's fake, deep fake videos of him. They've made all kinds of accusations against him. They've thrown corruption allegations against him. Everything. And all that it does is further increase Imran Khan's popularity. And now, in what Imran Khan is describing, and everyone else in Pakistan, all the commentators, is this is the pivotal moment. So Imran Khan says 26 years of his struggle, of his political struggle, to get true freedom from Pakistan is going to culminate now. It starts here. The final phase starts here. So Imran Khan yesterday made what he calls a final, he actually referred to it as a final time to talk to his people. He says, listen to what I've said to you today. Remember the day and remember my words today, because I don't know if I'll get the chance to speak to you again. Obviously referring to he's a name on a target as well. Yeah. And the only thing that's keeping him alive is the number of people that currently support him, and that it could go out of control in Pakistan if they did assassinate him, because that would be the easiest option. But the numbers
I wonder, looking at, I mean, it's an amazing picture you paint there of the ISI press conference with these people who are now running the country, yeah, actually rather concerned that perhaps it's not going their way.
Yeah.
And obviously they're being lent on, they're being blackmailed, they're being threatened, they're being, you know, possibly their lives threatened by a foreign power. And so, I mean, I wonder, maybe Martin, you can chip in here, how you think this one might go. It's interesting, Imran Khan literally, like, you know, today or yesterday, depending on which part of the world you're in, it's saying that this could be my last broadcast.
Well, you know, it could go either way, couldn't it? I mean, it's hard to judge from this distance.
I mean, surely it's very difficult for the Americans to remote control Pakistan from so far away. They'd have to have a whole load of more American forces in the country, or recruit a whole load of gangsters, sort of organized crime mafia within Pakistan, if they really want to keep a hold of the place.
Mm.
Well, the Pakistani army is, you know, it's embedded with the U.S. military infrastructure going back to the 1980s. That's and before.
Right.
And his daughter, Benazir Bhutto, she went to the same college I went to, at St. Catherine's College in Oxford. And when I was there, she left just before I arrived. But the year before I arrived, the ISA tried to assassinate her by trying to burn down her staircase in the college. And everybody knew who had done it and what it was about. And so the army has always been the power behind the throne, as it were, in Pakistan. But at certain periods, with US support, they have been the government. You know, the army ran the country. And this was during the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, which obviously had huge impacts within Pakistan. And of course, the creation of Al-Qaeda and all the rest of it by the ISI working with the Americans and the British. MI6 took the lead role in Operation Cyclone, which was, you know, funneling weaponry and other things into the struggle in Afghanistan, a lot of it funded by the heroin trade. Commerce International collapse, because that, you know, that was the source of a lot of what was going on. And I mean, you know, Pakistan is not the only country in the developing world to have this kind of dysfunctional politics, but it's a major country, and it's one it's got a great strategic significance. The Chinese are trying to build links to Gwadar on the Arabian coast, and the Americans are very unhappy about that. They want to try and stop that because they don't want that kind of development in Central Asia.
Mm.
And of course, and also Imran Khan was trying to open dialogue with the Indians and the Russians. He's not, you know, he's trying to solve problems rather than create them. And that's exactly why he's such a threat for them.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll definitely keep an eye on all this, Farouk. Do you want to just wind up with a final thought about how things may go now?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest change in the last 6 months is Pakistani general view of their own army. 6 months ago, I guarantee you, 6 months ago, you would not have heard anyone challenge or criticize the Pakistani army. It wasn't done because it was like, you know, you're feeding the help, India, you're feeding all the other enemies of the state, you know, because that's how the army always used their propaganda to make it so that anyone who criticized the army, oh, you're doing this on behalf of India or whoever the enemy was. 6 months later, and the perception of the army and the volume of attacks on the army and the way the army is generally now perceived in the country is a 180 degree turn. And that is, I think, a massive development, because as Martin said earlier, the army's always been in power. And in fact, what you've had here in March, when they removed Imran, was basically a soft coup. They put puppets in front and they took control of the country again, but with an image that we're still democratic. In fact, they control all the powers. And the subsequent response they've done to journalists and the crackdown on the media has proven that it's not, because when you ask the government, they say, we're not doing anything. When you ask the police, they're saying, we're not doing anything. When you ask the judges, they say, we're not doing anything. So the question is, who's doing it? And it's the army that is doing it all. And that, with the age of TikTok and social media and Twitter and all of that, suddenly people have woken up that the army is not the good force in the country that everyone once believed it to be.
Well, it could be their days are numbered. We shall see. Yeah. Very much watch this space, Farouk. Okay, well, thanks ever so much for just refreshing all of our memories. And also, of course, much of this is just simply not been reported here, even though, as you said, it's the biggest...
Yeah, and that's a surprise to me, because that's been a big surprise to me, because I would have thought, you know, nations on the side of right and freedom of speech would have at least jumped in.
But it's not just that, is it? You know, we've got a massive Pakistani community in the UK, you know, that wants to know about all this. And the media is quite obviously, you know, it's got its jackboot down on these stories. So what's a good way to keep up with this, do you think? Is any particular news outlets in Pakistan in English that we can follow or not?
Yeah, you can follow Ball. I think they've got a good English language, and you can follow ARY, B-O-L, just Ball TV. They've got a good English language issue. There's the Dawn newspaper, there's the Express Tribune, all of these Pakistani newspapers. Just type in Pakistan news and they'll all come up. But
well, okay, that's fantastic. Anyway, from the Pakistan Association in Bristol, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to have, Martin and I are going to have a look at this new book, finally wind up by having a look at this new book by Whitney Webb, One Nation Under Blackmail, where we're going to hear a clip now, 15 minutes or so, well, nearly 15 minutes from, as our final clip, from the podcast Financial Rebellion, which I think is a British, comes out of the UK. But Whitney, she begins by explaining her sort of investigative journalist role. She talks about herself as an independent researcher. Actually, I think she is an investigative journalist. That's what she is. She says that the term has been weaponized and she doesn't really like it. But anyway, I'm saying Whitney is an investigative journalist, probably one of the best, if not the best, on the planet. And it does rather reflect on the story we've just heard about the United States controlling Pakistan through the CIA. And she talks here about, and we'll just have a brief chat about it when it's finished, Martin. But I think it's an amazing job she's done in getting this book out, One Nation Under Blackmail. So let's hear from Whitney Webb now.
The mainstream narrative since Epstein's death has been, oh, well, he's gone. He was the one bad billionaire in the world, and so everything's fine now that he's disappeared. But no, there was a network that existed well before he came on the scene and continues to operate after his death. And in order to get to the root of the problem, you know, we have to understand the bigger picture, right? And see Epstein as a symptom of a very broken, very corrupt system instead of this standalone one bad guy who everyone knows is bad and everything's blamed on him. And you know, all of his, you know, quite obvious accomplices are more or less absolved, you know, with the, I guess, exception now of Ghislaine Maxwell. But she's apparently in country club prison now anyway, doing yoga and stuff. So, you know, and it's a bit of a complicated situation. And it turns out that, you know, I mean, the whole thing with Epstein, there's a massive cover up of it, because when mainstream media does give coverage to that situation, they focus exclusively on his sex crimes from 2000 to 2006. It's like they never talk about anything before the year 2000. And this was a person whose professional career, you know, began in the mid 70s. And so, you know, why can't we talk about these multiple decades? Why did UK media, but not US media, cover the fact that Epstein made 17 visits to the Clinton White House, or pictures of Epstein and Clinton shaking hands in 1993? US media just avoided that. I mean, that should be pretty telling to a lot of people. You know, that they don't want you looking at Epstein before 2000 and what he was doing, because if you look there, you know, it's bad news for Bill Clinton. It's bad news for people like Bill Gates, who were very powerful. And it turns out Epstein had a major role in the creation and development of the Clinton Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That would be very damaging if it came out for those foundations, which, as we know now, have an extreme influence on health policy globally and other policies as well. And it was Epstein, for example, who is even admitted by the New York Times to be a eugenicist, and things like that, who designed the HIV/AIDS program for the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Health Access Initiative, which works very closely with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and various other things. So, you know, it's very relevant, his involvement there, but they don't, you know, there's a lot of off-limits stuff with Epstein. It's like a very narrow window that people in the mainstream are willing to cover and discuss.
And how far back does this go? Where did you start your research? What sort of year are we talking about?
So the book really starts, I guess, in around the 40s, because what I'm basically trying to do is show how the network that Epstein entered into seemed to have come into existence, who were the big players, and how, and so that way, when I talk about how Epstein starts to fit into this in the 70s and 80s, you can see what world he's going into. Because it's not something that he just made, right? It's a world he was stepping into that was already there. And it's a world that intimately involves, you know, the offshore financial system, money laundering, intelligence-linked banks. There's a lot of financial crimes in the Epstein story. And, of course, that doesn't get a lot of coverage at all. It's, you know, like I said earlier, it's almost entirely focused on the sex crimes. But basically, both of those crimes were directly enabled by this group that is basically a coming together of intelligence and organized crime. And so where I start off the book is with something called Operation Underworld, which took place in World War II in the United States. And basically you had the Office of Naval Intelligence and the CIA's precursor, the Office of Strategic Services, making a formal alliance, which what is generally referred to as the National Crime Syndicate, which was basically an organized crime conglomerate that sort of brought together the Italian mafia and the Jewish mob. Because before the National Crime Syndicate, organized crime in the U.S. was mostly in ethnic enclaves, you know, like Italian, Irish, Jewish, and what have you. And so the National Crime Syndicate sort of eliminated those barriers and came together to profit immensely from crime, basically. And one of the heads of this system, that organized crime system, was a man named Mayor Lansky, who's often considered to be like the financial wizard of organized crime. And there's a reason that out of all the big name gangsters of this particular era that are sort of immortalized in Hollywood, he died of old age and never went to prison. It's because he had the money, right? and you know, managed all of that stuff. So, you know, I guess there is a lot more I could say, but basically beginning with Operation Underworld, you have those two groups come together. It's justified as being out of wartime necessity, but, you know, the war ends and the alliance continues and it deepens considerably to the point where, you know, maybe a couple decades later, you can't tell where one ends and the other begins. They become essentially the same. From 1987 up until around 1993 or so, Epstein was arguably the mastermind, or at least one of two masterminds, of what was then the largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history. So the person that took the fall for that with Stephen Hoffenberg. And Epstein's name, even though he was named by a grand jury, and basically the grand jury narrative was that Epstein was responsible, his name is dropped from the case. And that same year is when he's meeting at the Clinton White House, right? And so he goes from being a serial financial criminal with, you know, the Towers financial stuff being sort of the bookend to that era, and then becomes intimately involved in some of the most controversial fundraisers of the Clinton era as well, in addition to this relationship with Rubin, and then Rubin's deputy, Larry Summers, who then, of course, becomes Secretary of Treasury as well, and then later president of Harvard, and, you know, has a very long, storied relationship with Epstein. But then Clinton leaves office, and then the Clinton Foundation, which a lot of people regard as basically the Clinton family political slush fund, is being set up by Epstein. That's why all of these trips to Africa and things were happening, because Epstein was basically setting up a lot of the quote-unquote philanthropic efforts. And this is at a time when there was a big change in philanthropy. So at the time it was happening, people were calling it something like philanthropy 2.0. But I guess you could, you know, it seems more like it's impact investing. Before, that was like a common term. It's this idea of using philanthropy, but referring to your donations as return on investments. And this, and so this is the same era too when the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation starts. And I think your audience is probably familiar with like clips of Bill Gates referring to his philanthropic donations into vaccines or Gavi and all of that as a return on investment, that the return investment on vaccines is better than anything he's ever put his money in before, because the ROI is so big, and you know, things of that nature, or that Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, says it's about, on their own website, says it's about the health of vaccine markets and stuff like that. You know, basically disguising a lot of this predatory financial or commercial behavior as philanthropy. That's sort of what was going on in this particular era. And Epstein was really in the middle of it. And it's no surprise that you also have people like Michael Milken in that mix with the Milken Institute, who's also tried to rebrand himself and his foundation as major crusaders for healthcare. And it was actually there at the Milken Institute in 2019 that you have Anthony Fauci, Margaret Hamburg, and people like this saying that the regulations, existing regulations for vaccine, basically have to go kaboom and go away so that mRNA vaccines can come on the market at the end of 2019. So it's very interesting to see how, you know, all of these foundations involved in a lot of the controversial stuff going on today sort of have their common origin with these financial criminals. And if you look at what they were doing in the 80s and 90s, I mean, it's very clear that's what they are.
Well, I have a question. Michael, or Epstein was at Bear Stearns at some point, correct?
Yeah, so he was officially at Bear Stearns, I believe, from 1976 to 1981. He has to leave Bear Stearns under a cloud of controversy that, if you're interested in that, I'm happy to discuss. But after that, he became Bear Stearns, one of their top clients, and was involved in Forex trading to a significant degree, including the use of software for Forex trading that's tied up with controversial commodity traders like John Deuce, I think is how you pronounce his name, from Trans World Oil. And people like that who have a lot of ties to the CIA and intelligence were all sort of in this mix in Forex trading. And actually in 1995, one of Clinton's top donors, Lynn Forrester, now Lynn Forrester to Rothschild, wrote to Bill Clinton specifically about Jeffrey Epstein and currency stabilization. And that's kind of interesting when you think about what was going on in 1995, too, with like Mexico, the collapse of the peso, and all this other weird stuff going on in like foreign currency markets at the time, and how that was being used by, you know, people in the treasury, at the top of the Secretary of the Treasury and people like that, Robert Rubin's role and all of that stuff going on at the time. It's a bit odd. And if you look at a lot of mainstream media reports about Epstein, I mean, the foreign currency trading theme comes up a lot. Like, he was really involved. Sorry, still getting over an illness. Sorry about that. So he was really involved with Bear Stearns really until the end. He also had some offshore financial vehicles that were joint ventures between him and Bear Stearns that appeared to have engaged in very suspect financial activities up until the collapse of Bear Stearns. And it looks like if you look at some of how the story of the Bear Stearns collapse, and I didn't include this on the book, so I'm a little short on the details at the moment. But basically, he was involved in the first event that sort of set off the chain reaction that led to the collapse of Bear Stearns. And he supposedly lost a bunch of money, particularly in this joint financial vehicle that he had with Bear Stearns. But according to Wall Street on Parade, which is, I'm sure you all are familiar, they pointed out evidence that it seems like he got a bailout from the Fed, so he didn't actually lose any money. So I think that definitely needs to be scrutinized, because more often than not, a lot of these big economic collapses throughout the last several decades just seems to be massive wealth transfers to a very particular class, right?
Oh.
And so we're seeing that again now, happening now, and then with COVID and various other things in recent years. But like 2008 and other, you know, bubbles that have popped, you know, seem to be popped by someone and benefit a particular group, which more often than not are the people at the top, or the people with these kinds of associations. I know in the book, who have these ties to this particular networks where organized crime and intelligence have fused. And, you know, it's a complicated story, but basically, you know, this is a business. So eventually intelligence got really interested in just how to finance their operations off the books and without having to get money from Congress and all of this stuff. And so a lot of these illegal activities, whether it's money laundering, drug trafficking, arms trafficking, human trafficking, sex trafficking, whatever, become a major way of financing their activities. And then obviously a lot of those illegal activities, those rackets, are the historic territory of organized crime. So you can sort of see how there's this mutual benefit for these particular people, you know, specifically intelligence agencies that don't want to work with the government, or like, you know, oversight committees, or like work with Congress at all. They just want to be like, they want to run the show. You know, they really benefit from this type of association. And you know, it's important to really understand that's how power in the U.S. has been working for a very long time. You know, this isn't something that started with Epstein by any means at all. But you can argue in the 1980s, a lot of this just really, you know, exploded in a way it hadn't before and became maybe a little more visible to people who were looking. But, you know, it's really complicated history that I tried in the book to not make so complicated, because I am covering a lot of ground in a lot of stuff. But when it comes to Bear Stearns, you know, there's a lot of them. A lot there to dig out, and especially in terms of Epstein's financial crimes, because it's been so poorly investigated. And, you know, I do all right, but I'm just like a mom in Chile, you know, like I don't have like inside sources or like access to a lot of the stuff that maybe people in mainstream media do. I'm sure they could find out a lot more, but they're not interested in looking. And if you think about the only innocent person to turn up dead in recent years around the Epstein case, it was the son of the judge who was going to oversee the Epstein Deutsche Bank case. Everyone else that ended up dead was a co-conspirator, whether it was Epstein himself or Jean-Luc Brunel, who was involved intimately with the human trafficking side of things. And then you have, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell in jail. She obviously cooperated and isn't going to say anything. That's why she got moved to the nice prison, in my opinion. But, you know, there was an attempted hit on the judge. Her son was killed. And she was going to cover the Deutsche Bank case, because Epstein and Deutsche Bank, at some point, you know, after Bear Stearns collapse, he moves to J.P. Morgan, which had absorbed Bear Stearns. And it turns out that one of Leslie Wexner's top business partners was involved in choosing Jamie Dimon to be head of J.P. Morgan. But apparently whatever Epstein was doing at some point was too, you know, risky even for them. And then he moves to Deutsche Bank. Which, you know, if people have been looking the news lately, seems to be teetering towards collapse as the German economy gets a real squeeze. So, you know, there's a lot going on here. Again, I think there's a lot of history that, you know, maybe it happened a couple decades ago, but it's definitely having an effect on the present still. So, you know, it's worth understanding what happened before.
Sure is. Martin, I have to pat you on the back. I think it was you initially that introduced me to Whitney Webb when she was writing on Mint Press News. I think she's done a pretty good job. It's obvious what people need to get for their Christmas gifts this year. The book is One Nation Under Blackmail, quite an appropriate title.
Yeah, and what was not really apparent from the interview there is Epstein's relationship and Ghislaine Maxwell's relationship with Mossad and the Israeli intelligence services, who are of course embedded in these Western intelligence services stroke organized crime networks.
And I think what Whitney's saying,
this goes back to the Second World War.
Yeah, what Whitney's saying, I think, is that the CIA, MI6 and Mossad are basically a kind of cult operating in lockstep, in unison, but maybe led by Mossad. What do you think?
Well, you don't really need to think in terms of who's in charge. They're all in on it together. I think most people really don't understand, and they do need to understand, the relationship between our intelligence services and organised crime. So, for example, we were talking earlier about Pakistan. MI6 were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, which was channeling weaponry into Afghanistan, and it was being funded by heroin exports. And this goes back to the Second World War, when, for example, as the Allies invaded Italy, they released Luciano, who was a major Italian mafia figure, from prison in New York, and they put the mafia in power in Sicily and the whole of Italy as they moved north up the country to keep the communists out, because was that if there was a free election in Italy, the communists were going to win, so the mafia were put in there to make sure that they didn't.
Yeah, but what's so important, I think, about Whitney's work is that, I mean, we've been talking about Pakistan. Even the Western press does look at these abuses which take place abroad. But her lines of research are leading right into the US establishment, the British establishment, the Western establishment, and really getting, I think, much closer to the actual heart of darkness of all of this. I mean, this Operation Underworld is fascinating, though, isn't it? The idea that that was really the beginning of this network, which Epstein just happened to be one station along the line of.
Yeah, well, if you think back to the 1980s, when you still had a Democrat-controlled Congress and Reagan was the president, he wanted to sort of channel weaponry to the Contras in Nicaragua to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. But Congress was saying, well, we're not funding that. And the same thing happened in China, where they wanted to fund the nationalists, but the Congress was saying, this is in the 1940s, well, we don't want to fund that. So that's exactly the moment when Western intelligence services got into bed with the criminal fraternity, because by using, you know, by giving people nods and winks to deal in drugs, they were then able to generate slush funds, which could then be used to carry out terrorist attacks inside the Caribbean.
Trying in a way to go beyond Whitney's work, I mean, I've certainly done some work on the funding for the effectively what's become a kind of Fourth Reich mafia network, which was through Martin Bormann and the British, and Bormann over in South America, these two fascinating books, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, which came out in the 1980s, and then in the 90s, 10 years after, we had Christopher Crichton, a.k.a. Christopher Crichton anyway, John Ainsworth Davis's Op JB book, which follows the British and collusion with Bormann and the creation of these 750 corporations, the laundering of the Nazi revenue from looting in the Second World War through Switzerland, through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, into these 750 companies, and this rather cheeky idea of making Jews the chairman of many of these companies to disguise the fact that it was Nazi money behind them. And that's another aspect to all of this is, you know, exactly what was behind this kind of the financing behind this mafia empire that we're dealing with now, isn't it?
It is. And once you've got this working relationship between intelligence services and mafia groups, it just grows like Topsy. Yeah, I mean, as Whitney there says, you know, it's very hard to say whether the CIA and MI6 today are intelligence agencies which do drug dealing on the side, or are drug dealers which do a bit of politics on the side.
No, mate, in a way, it doesn't matter, does it? They're both.
No, it doesn't.
And the other thing is, we covered a couple of weeks ago, and I'm definitely going to look further into this. I had a bit of help from Steph up in Yorkshire giving me some interesting info about them, but it's this organisation called the Order of the Nine Angles, which is a terrorist organisation. They've conducted terrorist attacks. There have been arrests of youngsters, a lot of Polish people apparently involved in it, which is a satanic terrorist group based in the UK. which has actually conducted and carried out terrorist attacks, including certainly some similarities with the mosque massacre here in Christchurch. Certainly their ideology fits around that, although I'm not sure if they've managed to link it. I'm not sure if the police and the intelligence services here really want to link it. But incredible to think that such a group, white supremacist, Nazi, terrorist organisation, Martin, based in the UK, the government hasn't even seen fit to ban it.
Well, the intelligence services don't just fish in the murky waters of the drug industry. They're also involved in infiltrating and manipulating political movements, whether of the left, the right, Islamists, whatever. You know, Al-Qaeda was created by our intelligence services. Nobody disputes that. We just said, but they just went rogue and blew up the Twin Towers on 9/11. But
actually, Robin Cook did a terrific article in the Guardian about that, didn't he? The Guardian, I spoke to a guy called Andy who was working in the Guardian at the time, and he said all of the major advertisers who went through one agency the same day pulled 6 months of advertising from the Guardian because they published the article about Al Qaeda by Robin Cook, and then of course Robin Cook fell off a mountain.
That's right. The world is actually a much more dangerous and unpleasant place than many ordinary people realise.
But in a way, it's quite nice to see.
It has been for quite a long time.
Yeah, so see the Pakistani ISI kind of scratching their heads and wondering, gosh, how long can we keep this up? You know, that there are signs of chinks in the armour. And, of course, there are many good people within the system who are trying to make sure that there is a planet and a world to hand on to our kids. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers from Bristol Pakistan Association, also Farouk Sadiq, and sound engineer extraordinaire Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, quite a few this week I'll be putting up tonight, including maybe, I think I might actually even add a very interesting one by Scott Ritter, which you didn't have a time to dip into, and the long talk by Vladimir Putin. It would be nice to have had a bit of time to do that, but we may do that next week if it's still thought to be current, because we really wanted, I wanted anyway, to focus on Pakistan particularly, because it's such, I mean, you know, such interesting stuff going on there right now, literally this week as we speak. My paperback books are available via bilderberg.org, and they are on, including the one we were just talking about there, The Traitors of Arnhem, looking at the beginning of the financial Fourth Reich and the Battle of Bridge Too Far fame at Arnhem. They're available on eBay, and also if you want the main links to where to get, download the eBooks or the free book version of the these books, go to bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays UK time, and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and we've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft with Martin in Herefordshire and me in Coromandel in New Zealand, getting up at 4:30 this morning, I might add. The timing is exactly the same here as over there. It's just 12 hours difference. So censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm today in the UK, due to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, although we do see a little bit of a few chinks in the armour, don't we, from time to time. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, though. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. Until then, God bless. And don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
Tree. The name of the rabbit is not reported.